Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use jobs. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Carpcast. How you doing, Mark?
I'm not doing bad. How's your good self?
Yes, okay. Not too bad at all. Still haven't managed to put a fish on the bank this year.
Oh, dear.
Despite trying for a third time now.
You're a top big fish angler. You're supposed to lead by example and do these podcasts telling us tales of great big fish and monsters.
I can only catch big fish. I've been fishing day ticket waters, that's no problem.
You don't get small ones, is that it? Yeah, it's all right, because I've just rejoined an old syndicate and had my first blank on there, unless you count a big old bream.
So we're allowed to mention it, aren't we? Don't think anyone's going to come stalking you.
No, I'd quite like to be stalked, to be honest, as long as she's nice.
Yeah, the Apex, huge lake, isn't it, up near you? Or it used to be called the Apex, or it was called now. Yeah. North Highcombe, is it?
Yep, Highcombe. It's locally known as the Apex, that's his name. I believe it was Apex Farm that used to be down one end of the lake, which is where it got its name from. And it's just shy of 200 acres, a big chunk of water.
Yeah, big chunk. They stocked it with a load of Fisher's Pond years ago, didn't they? How big are they now?
They're reaching 30. I mean, at the stocking, there was a small number of originals that I used to fish for 15 years back when I first fished. Ah, oh, goddamn, I feel old. But 15 years back, we didn't know what was in it. And that size, we thought there was, how can I put it? Big pit, big bull. Because of all the stories I heard, only one turned out to be true. And that was of a fellow I've met. He's a nice lad. Can't remember his name though, but he found the fish in one corner and had four or five in an afternoon up to 29.
Right.
That was true. All the stories of people poaching the outer bounds and fishing off the island and going big 30s and 40s, rubbish.
Yeah, a typical big lake where people don't really know the truth because it is a big lake and they just make stories up, you know. I've seen it in loads of places. There's a couple that turn out to be true, but you know, look at the area of the country, look at the average size of other fish. You know, generally the ones that turn out to be true have got some sort of history. You know, the lakes in the same valley have all done 50s, you know, then you can believe that this particular nature reserve might have a 50 in it. But when, like, the biggest fish in the area for years is maybe 30 pound, then I can't see why this one lake would have loads of 40s in it.
No, it would have been nice if it did, but even though it was brilliant fishing back then, it still is. But I remember my first season, this is when I actually used to count the amount of nights I did. I did 42 nights on there. I had a 13-pound common and a 22-pound 10-ounce mirror.
I haven't done 40-plus nights in the last 3 years put together, I don't think. It used to be 60 nights a year when we were keener and more hungry on the syndicates. And
younger, more time, less commitments, less responsibilities. Real life gets in the way.
Yeah, definitely. So we're at episode 7 of the Carpcast. We plan to keep this going, as we said, every second Friday. We're going to release it. It is costing quite a bit of money to do this. We're going to hopefully take on some adverts at some point in the future. But a way you can help support the Carpcast now is dead easy, won't cost you anything. If you happen to buy anything from Amazon, we have a partnership deal. So if you click the link that's below the podcast, click that link. If you're just going to buy something off Amazon anyway, we get about 0.02% off it. So it'll help us. Some people have suggested saying that they would like to donate to keep it going. I've never really been comfortable about setting up a donations things. I don't know, I don't really donate to people, but people have suggested it on our page. I think we can get more creative about ways to monetize the podcast at some point, maybe some branding or t-shirts, hoodies, who knows. I think rather than just asking people for money, I don't do things for money, but it does it costs money to host this podcast. The SoundCloud account costs money every month. The Libsyn iTunes account costs money every month. The audio editing software is £30 a month. Logos, designing, all sorts of stuff. It adds up. It's not cheap, and I'm not sure we can do it forever for the love of it. But I think we need to be a bit more creative about, how we can make it pay for itself. We're not doing it to earn any money. We're doing it because we wanted to do this, and I think fishing needs a podcast in the UK. But the little thing you can do is just, if you're going to buy something off Amazon, just use our link that's below the podcast and all podcasts, and that'll help us somehow.
Yep, if it's your wife or girlfriend's birthday or any family member's birthday coming up, click our link and buy something from Amazon. If it's your birthday, get your wife to click the link, buy something from Amazon. You can drop a hint, direct her to some really expensive stuff.
Yep, it's a wipe. Shall we move on? There's plenty to talk about.
On the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yep, plenty on the net. Let's start with the big news. World record news. Eurowacker has done a 105-pound mirror carp to a Czech angler, Thomas Crisp.
Yeah, it's a matter of time before that place did it. 105 pound, 48 kilo is huge. We went into Euroaqua quite a bit when Ian McMillan was on the show, and then we deleted it all. And then when we got him back, we didn't really talk about it much because he wasn't there. But we'll probably get him on to discuss it at length. I'm sure Euroaqua is going to be in the news a lot over the next few years. So I'm sure we're going to get Ian back to talk about it. But it's not my cup of tea.
I think it's only a matter of time before it does the record again and again and again.
100%. It'll break the world record again before the fish spawn, I think. They're going to spawn pretty soon over there, I would have thought. It's a warmer country than us in the spring, summer, and we're only a couple of weeks away in the UK from spawning, I think, probably nearer on shallow lakes. But it's not my cup of tea. It's very, very commercial, but absolutely stuffed full of lumps. Don't get me wrong, I want to catch a 90-pounder, I want to catch a 100-pounder, but I think just the way the fishing's set up, your pegs are picked for you. You've got no chance of getting the best pegs unless you've spent quite a lot of money there, been on numerous trips. It's just a whole load of things that don't sit with my type of fishing. Not knocking anyone that wants to go there, but I'm sure as this place does 100 pound fish after 100 pound fish, there's going to be a lot of discussion on it.
Yeah, there was even a comment from Mark Rebo on our page when I posted up the picture I shared from Rob Hughes' Facebook about this picture. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said pretty much what you said. It's smacks of commercialism, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're fed. Them fish wouldn't have grown to that size without him feeding them at the rate he does, and he feeds them a lot.
I remember this similar sort of debates coming up for, remember a place called Davis Springs? It's fed up rainbow trout to 20, 30 pound. All your purists were going around in circles and jumping up and down about it.
No, I don't remember that one.
It's a long time ago. Probably before I even go into cartfish, when I used to read the Angling Times every week. But I do remember it well. Being a bit of a fluff chucker.
Yeah, it's going to be in the news a lot. The price is only going to go up. It's already expensive. You can hear a bit more info. If you listen to Carpcast 5, you can hear Ian talking about it, although not in the depth that we originally did. It's going to cost you anything from 1,500 quid to $2,500 a week. And I think if you want to make a habit of getting in the good pegs, you've got to spend a significant amount of that time not fishing and getting drunk with the owner, who's supposed to be a top guy, not knocking him at all. But I think that's kind of how you get in the good pegs, is because he picks the pegs for you before you get there, and he puts the people that he knows in the better pegs. And if I'm paying 1,500 quid and driving 25 hours to go somewhere, I want to feel like I'm fishing, not stuck in the arse end of nowhere. Although
yeah,
I think
carry on down the road and go to what's that place where they came from, allegedly?
Allegedly, Balaton. Lake Balaton. Yeah. Although I know Crowey's been there, and we've got Crowey on the show as our special guest a bit later, and I know he's going to shed some more light on all things foreign, because he's been going abroad for a hell of a long time. So we'll make sure we ask him about Balaton. But what else have you seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
I can't even talk. On the net, I did see an unfortunate tale. Now, I'm not going to mention any names, but there's something we can all learn from. Don't leave your gear unattended, because somebody might help the souls and nick it.
Yes, I saw this one too, regarding the A1 pits, place that I've been a couple of times recently and haven't managed yet to catch a fish out of.
The A1 pits, I find it easy down there, you know.
you're one for one this year, aren't you? One night, one fish.
I am. I'm quitting while I'm ahead.
I'm six nights for no fish, all on pit six. But to be fair, there's not been a fish caught while we've been there on pit six.
And well, I'm gonna have to arrange a tuition for you, mate.
Yeah, Cromwell for me next week. So hopefully I can get in a decent peg and put the bogeys to rest this year. I need to catch something.
You're gonna have a crap on his stock pond.
Yeah, well, that's the blank saver. So, yeah, I mean, the guy, I don't think A1 Pits has got a problem by any stretch of the imagination. It seems fairly well run down there. Bailiff lives on site. You know, there's a lot of regular anglers, so I don't think there's any sort of problem. I think the guy fishes out of his van, as you can do on a lot of pegs on there, was on the point on peg six, had to leave for whatever reason, and left the lake for 3 or 4 hours with literally his rods on the bank sticks in the peg with no bivvy and nothing else set up.
It was an opportunist thing, wasn't it?
Completely opportunist. But
I've seen it and had it. Just, all you can do is not make the same mistake.
Well, it started a huge debate, which is why we're talking about it. You know, a lot of people were saying that he's reserving the peg and, you know, it's his own fault, and he knows. I think from the guy's wife was posting on there, and he clearly knows it's his own fault. You know, it's unfortunate, but it's kind of different. Like, you're not reserving a peg when you've paid a day ticket. Like, if you're on a syndicate lake and you shot off to work and left your gear in the peg, then that's just selfish. That's out of order. But if you've paid, you know, whatever the day ticket rate is for X amount of hours, you've bought that peg for that time. If you want to not be in it, that's entirely up to you. You know, you've bought it. So, again, Facebook bitching. There's a hell of a lot of bitching about, you know, it's his own fault because he was trying to reserve one of the better pegs. And he's already reserved that peg by paying for it. You know, if he wants to leave his gear in there, you know, and shoot off, go to work for 2 days and come back, it's up to him. He's paid for the peg.
Yeah, just don't expect it to be there when he returns.
Well, that's the downside. I mean, no matter how urgent whatever it was, he had to shoot off. You know, it's nothing to throw the rods in the back of a van. So, I mean, you know, it's 60 seconds to reel him in, throw him in the back of the van. And presumably he reeled him in anyway. So, you know, he clearly did it to make sure he didn't lose the peg. And paid the price, unfortunately. Yep. But I don't want people to think there's bad stuff going on down there, because it was opportunist. But blimey, did it start some debates on the net.
Yeah, there's also what I've seen on the net, which takes us back to Capcast 3 with Rob Hughes, wasn't it? Talking about his appointment as England manager.
Yep.
As casting coaches, he's got Terry Edmonds and Mark Hutchinson on board.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yes, great. I did think when I read it, though, I thought, why are they not just going to be in the team rather than coaching your team members? You know, they're both why teach somebody else to do what you do, not as well as you do it, when you can do it yourself? You know, they're accomplished anglers. If I was the boss and the match was on a lake that needed, or I thought I had an advantage if we were fishing 180 yards, I wouldn't get the best caster in the country to teach someone how to do it. I'd get the best caster in the country to do it. You know, I know no team's been picked yet, and maybe Terry or Mark might be in the team. But to come on as coaches, I don't know. I mean, obviously that's what sports teams do. They pick the best coaches and pick the best young players. But for something as specialised as extreme casting, if you need an extreme caster, then why not get them to do it?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure Rob knows what he's doing, and I think it's a good move, because for that sort of thing you need, I would just thought you need to fish in the team, someone who's good at many disciplines.
And yeah,
if casting up with a bit of coaching, which both Terry and I believe Mark do.
Yeah,
it can only be a good thing.
If it's a, I mean, I don't, you know, the team hasn't been picked, and I don't know the venue. If the venue just needs you to be proficient at casting and not cast 200 yards, then yeah, you know, coaching everybody in all the skills. You know, I'm presuming Rob's not just getting casting coaches; he's getting all round coaches. You know, he's probably going to get a zig expert. He's probably going to get a bag expert. You know, I'm assuming he's going to, if he's getting casting coaches, he's going to cover all things. So yeah, to brush every, if every angler can get 10% better in casting, 10% better in, you know, bag work, 10% better in all the different skills, then obviously that's a good thing. But if you were fishing a Lake Balaton and or somewhere, and you know, it's just, if you can cast 40 yards further than everyone else, you are going to catch more fish. Then you just want the best caster as opposed to the best angler, don't you? Because the fish are going to be easier to catch where they're not used to getting caught from. If you can get that extra 40 yards, I would say that's a priority. But yeah, no, I'd take the point back, actually. He's probably just brushing everybody up to their optimum capabilities.
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, after my performance on Icombe this week, I think I need a session with Terry.
Well, I was fishing pit six, and the fish was showing at about 180 yards. I was fishing 0.34 line straight through, which is about 15-16 pound. I didn't have any super chucking line with leaders. I was fishing at like 125. I was putting a marker float there, spotting there, and putting a rod there, but that isn't long by today's standards. I'm sure I could have squeezed an extra 15 yards with 10 pound line and a leader.
Yeah, man, it's still long for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's no line about distances now, because you're wrapping them out, aren't you? You know, 25 wraps is 100 yards. And you know, we were obviously wrapping it, you know, casting a marker out, wrapping it for the spod, so you know exactly how far we were fishing in. I don't think it's particularly long when you're looking at the likes of Terry and that fishing hook baits at 160 plus. I think if I could have cast that far, I might have caught this week, because they were showing heavily out in front of us, but at super long range.
Yeah, I've seen a few fish showing in front of me on the first time I fished at Hykeham, and they were so far out it just didn't matter. I did get down there and chucked as close to them as what I could. And do you know how far I got?
Go on.
Not far enough.
Yeah.
I also managed to do something bad to my shoulder as well. It's still a bit sore. So I moved swim around to the other side where the wind was pushing in. And I know there's quite a ledge about 50 yards, and it's a lot easier to fish.
Yeah. What else have we seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
This is one that did make me chuckle. It's something that's going to come up again and again. Is tackle companies ripping each other off. I did see, again, I'm not mentioning any names, but one of these young Facebook startup companies, they brought out a hook. It's a nice rounded pattern, looks very like Corder's crank, so they've called it the crank. They've not even had the imagination to come up with a new name. So they have changed the name now to the CRK or something, but they did get quite a bit of slating, and rightly so, to be honest. It was your imagination.
Yeah, I mean, they could have called it crunk. I mean, if you look in other industries, you get a market, you know, you go in and look at aerial washing powder in the supermarket, and you'll see...
You are domesticated in your old age, aren't you?
You'll see whatever brand the supermarket is, have their own version of all the major, you know, the high volume, high selling stuff. You'll see their own brand with the same colour packaging and virtually the same and a slightly different name. It's just a cheaper version of it, like a home brand. And that's common in other stuff. So if a small...
Facebook one where the... or another young terminal tackle company, their packaging, from a distance, you would think it was Corder.
Yep. You know, I think is if you're going to offer a product, but you know, it's the same in anything. If you can go and buy Heinz baked beans, or you can go and buy a supermarket's own brand baked beans in a slightly different looking tin, you know, with a slightly varied name, you're quite aware it's just a cheaper version of the proper thing. And you know, if I was called, I'd take it as a compliment that somebody's copying them. I mean, yeah, I'd have changed the name slightly, but the whole point of it is to let you know that it's pretty similar to a crank. If you don't want to pay the full whack for the crank, then have a look at ours. Because let's be honest, most of this stuff's manufactured abroad, and
of course it is. And to be honest, anybody, we could do it if you wanted to do that. Put our Carpcast logo on. You just go to Alibaba, Google Carpooks, take your pick.
And put your own name
there
on
you
it.
Go.
Yeah. And quite often, you know, a lot of these companies, they're designing and innovating some of the products, but some of the products, they're buying it off the shelf and putting their own name on it. So yeah, it's not original. Some of it is, some of it isn't. I mean, I don't...
Even the crank hook itself. Look at some of the patterns that they used in match fishing. You know, for the pellet wagglers, it's very similar, just a bit smaller.
Exactly.
Go even further back, you look at some of the hooks that are used in fly tying, some of the sedge patterns. It's the same pattern.
Exactly, which is probably why, you know, they're not getting nicked, taken to court.
There's only so many things you can do with a piece of bent wire.
Yeah, but if I ran a business selling end tackle and I saw that product, Corder or Nash or Fox or anyone had an extremely high volume selling product that everybody wanted, and I saw it on the shelf, you know, why shouldn't I buy it and put my own name on it? Own name being the difference. I probably would have called it a crunk or something like that.
Crunk or...
Yeah, but it's gonna happen. You know, there's only so much stuff out there, and if this stuff is being sold off the shelf in these Alibabas and places like that, then why wouldn't any entrepreneur go and grab himself some?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Everyone seems to be a boxing expert temporarily all of a sudden with the... Are you fed up with that as well? I'm glad it's done.
A week of boxing and a week of politics. You know, everybody on Facebook was a political... what's the word I'm looking for? A commentator and a boxing expert. You know, I was sick of Facebook for that 2 weeks. You know, and the boxing was always going to be disappointing. So, you know, boxing fights are, especially if you got into the UFC. I mean, the reason why UFC is bigger than boxing in America now is because it's better. You know, boxing is a pretty boring sport these days.
It's just one-dimensional. They'll still get the odd exciting boxing match, I'm sure. But the best quote I've seen about the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight was someone tweeted, "Ordered a steak, got a salad."
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's better than paying God knows how much, 20 quid for a skybox office, and then him getting knocked out in 30 seconds. It's at least
which has happened.
Yeah, I stayed up and watched it with Powell's house, and wasn't enthralled.
Yeah,
that is for sure. Not worth staying up till 5-6 o'clock in the morning. Then couldn't get a taxi home because the whole world wanted a lift home at that time in the morning. All the taxi firms had the phone off the hook. Ended up having to download the cab app to get a taxi. It came straight away. The cab driver had no idea that all the phones were off the hook, but I think they just got fed up with talking to people.
Yeah, and as for the election, the only thing I'm gutted about is Al Murray didn't win.
Let's not get into politics on this show. Not nothing but fishing politics, anyway.
Yeah, we have enough of those.
What else have we seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Oh, a bit of end of an era. The baby orange dies from Yateley's car park lake, which is the last of the old originals.
It's the last one. I did see somebody comment, what about the pineapple? The pineapple is definitely not a Yateley original. When I fished Yateley, which is 10 years ago now, the pineapple was £17, anything between £15 and £17. And that was not classed as a Yateley fish. If you caught it, and now people are kind of clinging on. I don't know how big that fish is now, but it certainly ain't a Yateley fish. I would not be counting myself as catching a Yateley original if I caught that now.
No, although when you put it along with the stock now, when does a stocky become an original? it's more original than the rest of the fish that have been put since.
That is true. Well, it's not more original than them commons. The commons were in about the same time, weren't they? The bigger now. It was like 29, 30 when I was there. I remember when it first went 30. It's a good 40 now, isn't it, the big common?
I believe so. I'll be honest, I'm not too up on what's swimming around the carp out late nowadays.
I think it's got some chunks in there. I think the fish that they stocked, they handpicked a load. I think it was like the Viv Shears era. They handpicked a load, and I think they're chunks now. I think it's got quite a few 40s in there. Or a number, 3, 4, I don't know. I don't think there's a bad stock, and there's lots and lots of 30s. I think it's, you know, decent lake. Well, it was if there was 3 or 4 original swimming about, but obviously over the last couple of years they've gone one by one, with the baby-o being the last one to go. I remember seeing Darren Miles catching that. It was quite an epic picture that did the rounds. I was on the lake at the time when he caught it. He had most of them over a couple of years, if not all of them, I think. Did he catch them all in the end? He certainly had 7 or 8 out of the 9.
That's as good as, I think.
Yeah.
Did it make 40, the O, baby O?
Yeah, it was a good 40 when I was there. It was low 40s. But, I mean, 10 years ago, we were fishing for the mother in them days at low 40s. You know, the low 40s were the 52s of now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there was a number of them.
This is something new for us. Listeners' questions. So I put this post on our Facebook page asking for a bit of questions, something we can work off from our listeners. And we've got a few. We haven't got time to do them all because some of them require quite in-depth answers. But we'll start with the, well, probably my favourite, biscuit and brew of choice on the bank from Alex Malcolm. It's also, he says, something we should ask each guest, which we should, I think.
That's a good good point.
So, biscuit and brew, what do you go for?
Mine is actually the cheapest and most boring of all the biscuits, but they are so nice, they say nice on the packets. Nice biscuits, they're basically coconutty, sugary goodness, about 29p a pack, and that with a cup of tea is me.
I thought I was tight.
It's not the money, they're just my favourite biscuits.
No, I'll go through favours. I'm always coffee, one sugar, I need my caffeine.
I know. I remember now. Sorry to interrupt. I remember the biscuit of your choice. We downed many a packet 10 years ago. They're cool. Blue and with chocolate on the top.
Hobnobs.
Chocolate hobnobs. Boy, did we do some of them in. I remember now. Yeah,
they are without doubt the best Dunkin' biscuit on this planet.
To be honest, I'm redoing mine. I do buy Nice biscuits these days. But I spent 10 years... with 2 packets of chocolate hobnobs on a 2-day session.
Yeah, I've got to also give honorary mention to Jaffa Cakes. They're not such a biscuit, but I'm having Jaffa Cakes on every session. It is without doubt the best. So, yeah. This is another... Oh, have you got some more biscuit comments?
No more biscuit comments, but thank you, Alex Malcolm, for that. That's a good question, that one.
Yeah, next one from Lee Nicky Burns. Well, I'm assuming that's Lee Burns and Nicky's his girlfriend. They probably share an account. Now, this is a question for you. Did Ting Tong touch you inappropriately, seeing as he loves your voice so much?
I'm sure there's a few people out there with sexual harassment claims against Ting Tong, but no, it's a lot of years since I've seen Ting Tong in the flesh.
Do you think he wants to touch you inappropriately?
I think he groomed me from an early age.
Is this just something that should be discussed between you and your therapist?
Yeah, I'll get over it one day. Alex Malcolm, he's... I'd love to hear your thoughts on the embryo project. I think it's a fantastic idea, but the recent acquisition of the lake at Stanton Harcourt doesn't sit 100% with me. The aim of the project is to provide affording angling opportunities... sorry for my phone going off. Yet they have taken a water from £55 a year open membership club, changed it to a 50-man, £150 a year syndicate, which is the opposite of what they are trying to say and they're trying to do. Fully understand convenient for the club, but it just doesn't sit well with me. What are your thoughts? The MBO project, I believe that's Danny Fairbrass's project to take lakes over to help clubs otter fence and stuff there. I didn't know it was called the Embryo Project till now. I've not read a great deal about it. I don't read magazines so much anymore, but obviously I do troll the net. I've not seen too much about it from when they first launched it. Have you seen much?
I haven't had a look at it. Well, when this question came up, I went straight to the Embryo website just to have a look, and there is quite a statement on there about the Stanton Lake. And I've got to be honest, it sounds like a good thing to me. I can understand where locals might be a bit upset at the lake's gone from £55 to £150. But let's be honest, £150 in the days of syndicates nowadays has changed. Especially around that area of the world.
Yeah, and but there's... Plus, I can understand what this lad's saying if it's gone from £50 a year, but I mean, I'm presuming that Corder are going to develop this lake. I'm presuming they're going to spend money on it, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt. From what I read, there was otter fence mentioned, I believe 80 stockies being put in mentioned. And if the club was going to do that, the price would have gone up anyway, perhaps more than that.
Exactly. Dead Man's used to be, in Manchester, used to be £50 a year. They spent thousands and thousands on fish and put it up to 100. I think it's like 120 now, and none of the members complained because the water was improved. It was made loads better, and £55 a year is nothing. I've actually fished Stanton Harcourt. I know the exact lake. It's only small. It used to be on the Luton and Bedford ticket. It was either Luton or Bedford, or Luton and Bedford. Luton Anglers, I think it was, years ago. It had a couple of big ones till there was a fish kill on there. It was stuffed full of tench with a handful of carp. Went down there a couple of times and they died. Or most of them died. So I don't know what the club has stocked since, or whether the club have took it on. But I think a lot of people that complain about money stuff, they don't really understand how businesses work. I'm presuming that one quarter paid quite a bit of money for this, money that the club needed to do other stuff with, no doubt, otherwise they wouldn't have sold the lake. I know otter fencing, even around a small lake like that, I'm guessing from memory because it's 15 years since I've been there, but I remember it being small. I can't see it being more than 6-7 acres, but you're still looking at £10,000 to fence that properly.
Yeah, it's not cheap. And
no, and we know the price of fish, you know, if it, depending on how big these 80 fish are, but again, you could be looking at another £10,000 to £20,000 in fish, depending on the size of them. You know, stuff costs money, and I don't think £150, if they're improving the lake significantly, is much money at all. And if that ends up with 80 decent fish in a few years time that are mid 20s plus, where else are you going to get a syndicate of that quality for £150?
Nowhere. But I also think we should look at getting someone from Embryo maybe on the Carpcast and basically get the full story. So maybe you can address some of these concerns and get the correct information out there.
Yeah, we'll do some digging. We'll try and get somebody from the Embryo Project. I'd like to know more about it myself. I've not seen too much publicly. If you're listening, we shall be in touch.
Yes. On to the next question from Cletus Wally Winfields. That's got to have been a fun christening. He says, if you are to fish any bait other than boilies, what would it be, why, and what rig setup would you use? Cheers. God, how long's a piece of string?
Yeah, mine's an easy answer. Tiger nuts. I spent a good 10 years of my early fishing days fishing solely tiger nuts. In the horseshoe days, where I kind of not learned my carping, but it was the first like serious lake we used to travel to, and it was a tiger nut water. You'd spot a bucket full of them out, you know. We used to prepare them, get them all gloopy. You'd have to prepare them a week before you went to really get all the juices coming out of them, and the water would thicken up like syrup. They smell beautiful. I used to fish either two tiger nuts with a piece of cork in between. I used to save up all the kind of corks off bottles of wine and anything I could find in those days. Or because cork is actually quite a similar colour to the tiger nut, I used to just fish one tiger nut and a piece of cork cut to about the same size as the tiger nut on the back of it. So kind of snowmanny. And just a normal knotless knot type setup. It wasn't a knotless knot in those days because I don't think it had been invented. But Yep.
I remember the first time someone told me about this knotless knot, I thought they were taking the piss.
Yeah, it used to be just a hair straight off the eye with a bit of silicone tubing down it for me.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, that would be my second choice bait.
What rig setup would you use?
I use same as I use now, kind of like a 6-7 inch normal knotless knotted type setup, with hair coming off the back of a twister hook, a little bit of tubing on it, and same as I fish now. Like now I fish like a 15 mil bottom bait with a barrel shaped pop up on the back of it as a snowman, and I'd do exactly the same as that, but using a tiger nut and a bit of cork. Foam these days, probably. But cork's good because it's the same colour as the tiger nuts, and you can soak it in the tiger juice as well. Just I'd have the bits of cork cut up in my bucket in the juice.
How about this one as a bit of a curveball? Any other bait other than boilies and what rig? Bits of foam on zigs.
Other than...
That's got to be a good alternative.
Yeah, if you were going to use... I've got a feeling the zigs are going to blow, though, over time.
Really?
Yeah, I've got a feeling that they're going to...
get banned.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Did we... we talked about the zigs getting banned over on Lynch, did we, last time or not?
I don't think we did.
No, you're right. Here's a... And on the net, it must be true. Well, it definitely is true because I've got friends that fish down there. The Lynch Hill fishery have banned zigs and maggots down to... a load of fish being foul hooked. I think there was like 7 or 8 fish in a week on Christchurch being foul hooked. I know of plenty more sort of earlier on in the year. I'm guessing if you got a lake full of anglers with... I'm sure we spoke about this last time, actually.
We spoke about them being foul hooked, but not the actual ban coming in.
Ah, right. Well, yeah. Obviously, since then, yeah, they've been banned, so... the maggot one was always an issue on there because Christchurch used to get hammered in the winter and it used to kill the fish in it. They'd get hammered for a few weeks and then it'd just switch off, but people use serious amount of maggots. That's neither here nor there. There's lots of fisheries that ban maggots for carp.
Yeah. Also, did Rob Hughes mention in his interview with us about maggots that you just do not need to put gallon after gallon in? They don't wriggle away, they just freeze and sit there.
Yep. Yeah, I remember. The zig rig one's interesting. I mean, we've discussed zig rigs so many times on this show, and the jury's still out with me, even though I use them. There's something that doesn't sit right with me about them. Not to mention the light line, the amount of fish getting lost, amount of fish getting drop-offs, hooks pulling out. They're not as easy to land on the long hook links, and the fact that so many fish are getting foul hooked. They were banned on Cuttle Mill years ago for that exact reason. I mean, Cuttle Mill was only 3 or 4 foot deep, so if you imagine zigs everywhere mid-water, it was just like a minefield for the carp to swim through. They were getting caught in the pecs usually, constantly, and I think the same's been happening on Lynch. So to protect the fish, Julie's banned them down there, and I've not really got a problem with that.
No, me neither. Mainly because, well, two reasons. I don't fish there, and the other one, I'm not a massive zig fan anyway. I will use them. I have had the odd fish on them, but like you say, I don't like playing them on the long hook link, and I know with my bottom rigs, if I get a take, I am 95% sure I'm going to land it.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
great. Let's
move on. Dan Robson. He's actually a friend of mine. I just noticed he's put this. I like Dan because he makes me look slim. The big lad. Most memorable catch and why?
Well, this could kind of answer James Mosley's question as well, saying he likes the show and he wants more talk about captures, waters, tactics, and less talk about products. Don't think we really talk too much about products other than stuff that's in the news, but your most memorable catch and why is answers the other bit of his question.
Yeah, that's kind of go together. Now, I'll just say about the mentioning products, because nobody likes blatant plugs all over the place. It's a constant whinge at the magazines, But I can say for the Carpcast, any products that do get mentioned by either of us, it's because we use them, we think they're the nuts, and do they deserve a mention? No other reason.
Except if somebody wants to pay us to mention other stuff, we're quite happily to take money off people. No, we never sold out.
No, not yet anyway.
Not yet. We do need to pay for this podcast somehow. You know, I can't afford to be weighing out £150 a month forever. But we'll see if we can get creative with that without annoying the listeners with loads of adverts. Yeah. So what is your most memorable catch?
Mine? Oh, my God. Should be which most memorable catch? I would have to say, this is going to sound boring, but I know we've also covered it already, so I'm not going to go too into depth, but the fat lady from St. Ives, because not only was it a personal best and still is, but also some of the other situations, because, again, I'm not going to go too into depth, but April that year, I was laid up in hospital, a leg not working, and genuinely not knowing if I'd even fish ever again. 1st of August that year, I've caught my target. I'm back on the bank and done what I love.
Yeah, it's not just about the, you know, the size of the fish. Sometimes, like I say, there's other factors that, you know, you were laid up maybe thinking I'm never going to fish again at one point. So, you know, it makes it even more special when you do catch one. The fact that it was, you know, a monster carp anyway is may or may not be here or there. But whatever your target was that year, if you'd have caught it, I think you'd have been happy.
Yeah, I was happy to catch bream once I got back out on the bank.
I've had...
Novelty soon wore off.
I've had sounds like proper brags here, but I've caught probably 3 or 4 once in a lifetime type fish, you know, them ones that are super special. But I guess the most memorable one would probably have to be the first one, which was the Colmere banana common. That fish was mythical. The way I judge it, I mean, I've had the Tatton common at mid-50, the one that's died now, the other one at 48, which were both absolutely, like, amazing, given the hardness of actually physically guessing, if I was to have guessed it, allegedly. More on that with one of our friends being in court over allegedly fishing the same lake later on.
You're allegedly saying allegedly a lot.
Yes, well, not wanting to incriminate myself. But there's been a few. The only way I can pick the most memorable one is how I reacted at the time of catching it. By the time I caught the Tatton fish, I'd caught a fair few big fish and a fair few kind of sneaky ones over the years. And yes, I was absolutely ecstatic to catch a mid-50 common. But if I think of like the adrenaline and the excitedness, it's 100% the Colmere fish. I remember ringing Dave Levy at the time. We were quite close in them days. And, you know, screaming down the phone to him, like, I remember I was running around the other side of a 100-acre lake, you know, to get some signal and ring people and sort stuff out. And I was, as much as I've caught bigger fish, as much as I've had a few memorable catches, nothing's ever equated to that one in how I felt at the time. And even when I think, maybe I've caught other fish that was just as much of an achievement or bigger or whatever, just think back to how I was that morning. I'll never forget that as long as I live. I was bear in mind, these fish, for anyone who doesn't know Colmere, it's a lake in Shropshire, 90 something acres, 7 carp we believed lived in there. I'd never seen a carp for the first 30, 40 nights I'd fished it. The rumour was, I got this rumour from Terry Hearn, because one of his close friends had fished on there for 7 years. He'd had one fish in 7 years, and he had fished it heavily over those years. A very good angler, you know, a guy that's in Terry Hearn's first book, you know, not saying that he did anything wrong, because the guy's an extremely accomplished angler and a top guy. But, you know, Terry told me these fish were impossible to catch. Said they're natural feeders. You ain't going to catch them. he'd looked at it, but these fish were supposed to be potential record size. There was the old story, two big commons and an even bigger mirror. That they were the rumours. And I didn't know if it was true or not, but I had nowhere to fish, so I had no tickets. I'd caught the mother and the twin out of Elstow and expected to be on there a few years. And as you know, it all went to plan in 1 year, so I ended up with nowhere to fish and nothing to lose. So I ended up going on to Colmere, not seeing a fish. I went straight on there in the October after I caught the twin, fished it up till Christmas, did 30 odd nights and never saw a carp. I had tench, pike off the bottom, no carps. Never heard one, never saw one. Went back in the spring. First couple of sessions, it done me nothing, never saw anything. I was determined not to give up until I'd seen a fish, you know. And I remember like 2 days in the first session, wanting to go home, just felt beaten up, you know. I was really trying hard and, you know, didn't even know. I didn't know for sure it was a carp even lived in there, bar this one Terry's mate had had. And anyway, I ended up formulating a plan, pre-baiting. I was driving an hour and a half each way, to hour and 40 minutes each way, just to pre-bait. I got a proper plan together and it came together. I started seeing fish, lost one, although I saw it was a low 20 common, so I wasn't too, don't get me wrong, I wanted to catch it, but it wasn't a British record, which is what was rumoured to be swimming about in there. And then it came good. One session I ended up losing the big mirror and catching the banana common, which was £40 and a bit at the time, which was a massive carp in them days. Like I say, you were joining syndicates, the top syndicates in the country might have one or two low 40s, 41, 42 pounders in. So to catch a £40 common that was a rumour in my eyes, I never knew for sure it was there. I hadn't seen it, and I just remember that feeling when it went over the net cord and knowing it was a big common, bigger than anything I'd caught before. It was wow, you know. I was just couldn't breathe, you know, and you're like talking to people, ringing up, hyperventilating, and I've never felt like that about a fish since, even though I've had some great captures. So that has to be the most memorable.
Yeah, I think I remember rightly, I was on holiday at the time, and I remember getting back, phone coming into life, and listening to this manic answer machine message.
Yeah, manic is probably the best way to describe it. You know, it was a corker. And I don't know why. Like, say I've had some good captures since, and some of them, you know, I might think are better, but it's not. When I think back to it, nothing made me feel like that one did. Like nothing. So. Should we move on?
Yeah, well, so the next question. Sorry, I've just lost. Ah, here's a good one. Elstow related from Dean Seath. If you could choose one tactic to target the mother on pit two, what would it be and what time of year? P.S. Hard epileps out. Whoop, whoop. Smile, emo.
Well, congrats on epileps. I never caught that one.
No, I mean, I pulled out of it. I watched it. I was on the flat bank. It was not much of a fight, just typical big fish plodder. It's scrubbing left to right slowly, about a foot down. I can see exactly what it is. And the hook fell out.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that story before I started on there, wasn't it? It was the year before.
It was my first year, I think. I only fished about 15 or so nights on my first foray to there, and had a little common about £4 and the sausage, and lost that one. That was a... hooked, but yeah, I did photograph that fish a couple of times, and it's an absolute stunner. It's nice to hear it's still going, and I believe Scaly's still around as well, you know.
Is it? I'd like to have caught that one as well. I mean, I was going to stay on after I caught the twin, the mother. I caught the two biggest, and I didn't catch any of the other mid-30s at the time, and I remember saying to Roger, I want to stay on and catch the others. You know, I was really enjoying my time on there and started to work out the puzzle, and his exact words were, do you think Terry Hearn stays on a lake after he's caught the biggest fish? Get on to the next one, you know, which inspired me to go on to Colmere. So he was right, but I kind of felt like I hadn't done it all, you know. I wanted to catch the others, but
apparently, were you two doubles and two 40s?
Yeah, and a couple of losses, two or three lost, I think.
Yeah, I think I went the other way around and managed to get me fill a small one. Not them all, you know. I didn't get the mother, scalene epilepse, never saw my net, although a fair number of the other ones did. So, like I say, it was such enjoyable fishing down there.
Yeah, well, it was a big difference from the pit across the way.
Yeah.
We'll maybe go into that one another time.
Yeah, so if you could choose one tactic to target the mother, what would it be? Seeing as you caught her, or him?
Well, it's a pretty easy question, that one.
Mother weather.
I've actually contributed to, or I'd like to think I have, to a number of other people catching that fish. Once we kind of sussed out its habits, I've put a couple of other people on. For 3 or 4 years after we fished that season on there, I've predicted almost exactly the day when it's come out on 3 or 4 occasions, because the mother weather, as you say, it likes them big westerlies. The nastier the wind, the more chance that fish is getting caught on it. It likes a new moon and it likes the deep water. So without doubt, the headland or the low point, if they still call those pegs that, any of them in the deep water in nasty weather, and you've got an extremely good chance of catching it. I don't think it's too fussy bait wise. I caught it on, what did I catch it on? Was I still on mainland? I'd gone on to Nash by then. Can't remember.
I think you were still on the was it NRG back then?
Could well have been NRG actually. Yeah, that's a good point.
You had that before the twin, so it must have been.
Yeah, it was just down the marginal shelf, found the base of the onion weed, found a little hard spot just after that, 22 foot deep, and that's how most people have caught it, I think, apart from when it's been caught in the back bay, but I think generally it's been caught in the deep water, and I'd just find a spot and keep introducing the bait. It definitely reacted to pre-bait in that lake.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain I lost it through the back bay, but the other question, part of the question, what time of year? I think any time of year when that weather comes in, even winter.
Yeah, I've seen it caught in February. I've seen it caught on one of the grimmest, coldest easterlies in March. Eddie had it last week in March, first week in April, in really cold weather. It came out that year in the February as well.
Yeah, I was a fella called Justin. I also remember Ian Stott had it. I think that was a December or January capture. Remember, I think it was that session or the session before, sat having a brew with him. You know, he's saying he's done so many nights blank. People are telling him to pull off, he's mad. But then he gets the mother, and I believe he had scaly in that session as well.
Scaly's braced with the mother a lot, isn't it? I didn't have it with it. But
quite a few times.
There's a number of people that have caught them both in the same session or braced them. So they definitely hang about together. So, yeah, that's my Elstow 2. Maybe we'll move on to Elstow 1 at some point. But let's move on. Nick Rustage. I've got a problem with bad mouth fish, and it's something that never comes up in mags, thinking tackle or anything. They hold the fish in a way that you can't see it, and it really gets to me. Do you think something should be spoken about more? So what I'm saying, people are hiding them for the photograph. Is that what he means?
I believe so, yeah, and I've got to totally agree with him here, because, let's be honest, a knackered mouth on a fish, it ruins him. I mean, you say we'll talk about Pit 1 another time. I'm going to talk about it now, because my first fish out of Pit 1 was also my first 40, a cracking breeze block of a mirror called the Unattended, and its mouth was an absolute disgrace. Its bottom lip was like my big toe.
I don't want to picture your big toe.
Well, one of them's not even got a nail on, but that's another story.
I don't get this guy's problem. Yes, fish have bad mouths. Yes, there's stuff that can be done about bad mouths. It's generally the standard of angler. I mean, a lot of the syndicates I've fished, fish don't have bad mouths because, you know, it's a syndicate with reasonably accomplished or experienced anglers, and they're not ripping hooks out and stuff. You know, it's generally on with pleasure anglers on heavily stocked lakes. But I mean, as far as
having said that, I'm gonna have to disagree with you there, because there was several other pit one fish were a mess in the mouth. When I had the slag, which was, I had it about 38, it was occasionally mid 40, the mouth on that one wasn't too great either. And you know what it all comes down to? People fishing locked up in the reed swim, they get a couple of bleeps, they pick the rod up, they won't even bend into the fish or bend slightly and just walk backwards.
Yeah, I forgot about the reeds factor, actually. I'm guessing that's why they've got rip mouths in there. I never really had any fish with rip mouths in there, so it's not something I've come up with. But obviously I've seen it on commercial waters or on busy waters with inexperienced anglers. It's common and it's not nice. But as far as, I mean, Nick's comment about hiding it from the picture, I mean, that's just common sense. You know, if a fish has got a knackered mouth, you're going to put the good side on. You know, nobody wants the bad side in a picture, do they? Everybody wants their good side. So I mean, that's just common sense.
That's true.
So I don't know why it would annoy him.
Well, perhaps it's just something you think should be spoken about more, a bit more education, and mainly how to fish in, up to snags, up to reeds, in weed. Because again, the Mester Syndicate, another syndicate water I fished the other year, I had a fish out of my first fish, one they called the drop tail linear. You know, cracking up a 20. But again, its mouth was a mess.
I had a lot of fish out the reeds. And, you know, I employed that kind of bullying tactic to get them out of fish locked up. But, you know, if you're on the rod, you hit it. I never pulled out of any. The only fish I lost in that peg was where I got cut off on the reeds. You know, I had a decent hook hold every time and I pulled the fish out. And that kind of, that dragging them out, I mean, it sounds kind of barbaric, but it knocks them off balance. You're not really dragging them, you knock them off balance and you can just wind them in. They don't fight once you stop them on that initial run, i.e. you know, when you bend into it, you just don't give them an inch. It turns their head and you can just wind them in. It almost shocks them. I had a dozen fish out of that peg over a couple of sessions, and it was surprising, but like how much stick you can give a rod. That point where you think, you know, something's going to snap, the fish just turns and you literally wind it straight into the net. And not once did I ever, you know, it was a solid hook holding it. The hook didn't move. There was no more of a prick than any other time I hook a fish. So I don't know how people are kind of pulling out of them in there. And if that is the reason, I can only assume, on a lake like Pit One with a lot of experienced anglers, I'm not really sure why so many fish would have bad mouths except for fishing in the reeds. But, you know, I was always on my rods. If I ever had to even, you know, go away from the rods at any point, you'd reel in. It's one of them where your bivvy had to be virtually touching the rods and you had to be able to pick the rod up, you know, within seconds.
And fishing that swim, your bivvy, literally while your rods are out, it became your little green prison cell.
Yeah, it was an intense peg to fish because it did do quite a few bites and you couldn't, you know, if you weren't on that rod, you were getting cut off. I can only assume maybe the mouths are from where people have been cut off and the fish is dragging a rig and it's you know, it's had to eject the rig itself by ripping it out. That's the only way I can maybe think. I'm not sure, but yes, I mean,
I don't think what is coming, or maybe one or two magazine articles, you know, just show, look, this is what happens if you don't do things right. You know, there's plenty of articles about how to fish in weed, obviously, and how to fish up to snags.
Yeah.
So maybe there should be more just showing what happens if you don't do it right. If you don't do it right, don't do it.
It's not something I've come into contact with a lot over in recent years. Like I say, I don't fish the sort of lakes where it's a problem, and this year I don't catch any fish to see if they've got a bad mouth or not. So, but I mean, it's, as a rule, it's inexperienced anglers. The lead core craze kind of contributed to a lot of ripped fish mouths. I have seen fish that have been cut off in the trailing lead core where it's catching on everything, you know, they're giving people false bites with trailers, and I've seen damaged mouths through lead core, that is for sure. I don't think I would allow lead core if I owned a lake.
No, I definitely wouldn't. Not because it's bad, but because you have to cater for that lowest common denominator, and it only takes one person to set it up incorrectly, crack off and kill your biggest fish.
Exactly. But, you know, it was tubing only on Elstow. So, again, I'm a bit confused about why so many Elstow fish had bad mouths. Should we move on anyway?
Here we can. We've got Charlie Dempsey. Who's your top three anglers and why? Keep up the good work, lads. Great listen. Well, thanks, Charlie. So go on, Jamie. Who's your top three?
I'm going to have to go old school, mainly because I don't read magazines. And every time I do see the front cover of one, I don't recognise anybody on there. So there's probably tons of really good anglers out there now that I just don't know about. So I can only go back to my era. Yeah. It's a tough one.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll start it off. And I'm going to go with one fella who influenced me in my fishing. And he's still at it now. And we've also mentioned him quite a few times. Is Dave Lane.
Yep, without doubt.
I've got to put him number one. I remember seeing in an old mainline advert, he's holding up 440s from Horton. Back when, you know, 440s in a season, it was just unheard of.
Yeah, I'm only going off anglers that I've witnessed fishing because, yeah. You know, I've got a pretty decent CV of carp, but I certainly am not in the top 20 of people that I could name anywhere near yet. Yeah, you know, the scores on the doors probably stand up against anybody's captures, but, you know, there are some people out there that are absolute machines. Love him or hate him, Shelley's got to be the top of that list. There's nobody as consistent as him for catching carp. I might not agree with his ethics as a human being, but as a carp catcher, there ain't many better. He's got to be in everybody's top three. He's too good catching fish.
Yeah. Did that pain you saying that?
Not at all. No problem with him personally. You know, I have my opinions on him based on personal experiences and witnessing him dealing with other people. He's not a very good human being, I think, but he is a great carp catcher, and he would probably be my number one, I would say.
Okie doke, so I'm going to go for my number two, and I'm actually going to discuss someone here that no one's ever heard of. This is a friend who actually met on Highcombe years back, a bloke from York called Sean Ong. Now, you know when you see people who are just naturals?
Yeah.
Everything they do is just so fluent, and they catch. He's one of those. You know, learned a lot off him. I haven't actually seen him for quite a long time, good few years. So, if you ever, I don't think you will, but if you listen to this show and get in touch. But he was just, not just carping either. He used to fish like winter matches, winter leagues, and I've seen him on Icom, the Apex, Saturday with three carp rods out, and he's on a box next to his rods with a pole.
Yeah,
very fluent, very good angler.
Johnny Mack's got to be up there, I think, as possibly my top three. For somebody, when he's on form on a lake, he's a machine. He's another one that I always remember Daryl saying to me on when Daryl and Johnny Mack were on Collingbrook at the same time. I remember him saying that, like, Daryl's obviously right up there, you know, he's certainly in the top 10.
Yeah.
If not higher than that. And I remember Daryl saying, he said, you know, if you kind of knew where you needed to be, you'd work something out. You saw where the fish were moving at a certain time in the mornings. By the time you'd just worked it out, Johnny Mack was already there. Like, he was like, I just saw something out. We'd seen the fish. There was a pattern emerging. And then you'd just think, right, I'm going to move. And you'd see Johnny Mack with the gear on his back on his way to the spot you'd just sussed out. So, yeah, I think when John's in the zone, there's nobody better. I don't think. My number three, I think I'll probably go, I think Roger Bacon, Northern Angler, somebody we might get on very shortly because I know he's on the bank. Our new feature, it's on the bank when we speak to people live. I think we're going to give him a call shortly because he's down on Dinton and I believe he had a fish last night. So,
nice.
But yeah, he's another one when he's in the zone. There's nobody as efficient an angler as him, I don't think, that I've come across personally. What about your number three?
You know, I'm just thinking hard. I was actually thinking of Roger, to be honest, because after seeing him fish on pit one, he's again what I'd class as a natural, just very fluent and always seems to catch. So I'm going to have to go for something else now. I don't know, actually. There's that many to choose from.
I wish
so.
Which next door's dog had shut up. I never hear it barking except for when we're recording a Carpcast.
Do you think it's a fan?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Not as much as Ian McMillan, but maybe it doesn't like my voice.
No, that's probably why he's barking.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might have to abstain on a three. I can't actually think. And I don't want to give you too much editing to do of me going,
Fair enough. Decent question, but we're probably way out of time out of tune with the modern carp scene. So here's a question I like. Bite times. Kevin Etherden. What determines the difference from seemingly similar waters night, morning and afternoon? Why does the pattern change as the season goes on? Well, I think it's good that you notice that, because it certainly does change. Certain times in the autumn you can set your watch by the time, and in the winter as well, you can set your watch by bite time. I've fished a number of lakes where it varies. You know, certain times of year it's first light, which is probably the most common bite time on any lake, I would say. If I had to pick 3 hours of the day where if I could only fish 3 hours in a day, it, without doubt, it would be the hour before it got light and the 2 hours afterwards. At any time of year, they are probably the most common times. But I mean, there's certain times of year it's middle of the night, certain times of year it's like tea time. I remember on Wire I got a take every day at 5 p.m. like every single night. I fished it for the entire September and October. If I was going to catch, I would catch one at 5. I'd also get one about 2 in the morning, but the 5 p.m. one was literally set your watch to it. And bite times they do happen. It's like something switched on. You know, people all around the lake will catch at that time sometimes, not just one peg. So he's asking why.
I think light levels have a lot to do with it.
Certainly, but I mean,
especially coming out of winter.
Yeah, I mean, this. I know the Manchester Park Lake, there's a few people I know have been fishing on there at the minute, and that's generally a daytime water. It does do fish in the mornings, but afternoons are common. There's not many lakes I've fished where afternoon is one of the most prominent times, but that is one of them. And yet at the minute, all the bites are evenings and nighttime, which is unusual for there. I mean, less than 10% of the entire season's catches come at night, I would say, which is unusual. Back when I was a kid, all the carp bites came at night. You know, daytimes were a waste of time on a lot of lakes, because night fishing was less popular 20 years ago and 25 years ago, probably now when I was really young out there. And you would just catch twice as many fish if you fished at night as you did in the day. I think obviously now most people, like a lot of lakes, their rods aren't even out in the daytime. You know, they fish till 10, 11 in the morning, they reel in, walking around, socialising with the pals, and put the rods out again, you know, late afternoon, tea time, ready for the kind of the night and early morning stint.
Yeah, it is a thought. Just imagine somewhere like, use like the Woolpack or Car Park as an example, a small pressured lake where the fish are pressured. Do you think the feeding times can be influenced by pressure? Whereas people can take their rods out of the lake, they go around, they have socialised, but if you're that one person who leaves your rods in through all the unfavoured times, you can pick up the bonus fish.
100%. I've seen that happen loads of times on lakes. You know, that time. In fact, in the first Euro Acro Ian McMillan interview, he was saying about that. He said lots of people reel in for dinner, didn't he? And he said you can just see the fish go mad. It's like, because it's the same time every day, like a regimented dinner time, it goes crazy. Yeah. You know, if you miss dinner and stay, you catch. Although nobody's heard that because we deleted it, but it never gets old, that joke.
No,
yeah, I've seen
I do believe we heard something special never to be heard again.
There's lakes that are pressured, they definitely react to bite time. There's lots of lakes. I remember in the early days of Horseshoe, it used, even 20 years ago, it used to be extremely busy at weekends. Could be 50 bivvies on there at weekends. And it would switch off. So, yeah, occasionally loads of fish came out, but generally it didn't fish as well when it was super busy. Mondays used to be a little bit iffy, and Tuesday would be the hot day every week. It's just like the fish had got over the weekend. It was generally quiet, and it was Tuesday was bagging up day. Literally every week, the fish didn't just have a time body clock; they had a day body clock. I've seen it on other lakes. Remember on Elstow One on like changeover days, and like Fridays when, because everybody had to reel in for the rotors at a certain time. And everybody used hemp and corn on there, hemp and pellet on there, so you could see when the shoals of fish were on the spot, because it had just slick up and just totally flattened the water off. The amount of times at 12 o'clock on a Friday when everybody had to be off for the, or 10 a.m. on the Friday, and then they'd do a rotor at 12, didn't they? So there was like a 2-hour period where all the spots in the lake, you might have blanked for days, and then the fish would just go crazy because they knew. And it, you know, it was 2 hours twice a week, basically, the rotor changeover days, and the fish knew what day it was.
Yeah, there's another thing that just popped into me. I had the match angler I used to live next door to. I remember having this conversation with him about, because I mean, carp are carp. Yeah. Whether they're in an overstocked commercial, which is the sort of lakes he used to fish. And I remember him telling me for the last hour was always the best of a match, especially if your neighbour had not caught anything and decided to pack up early. Because it seems that them pulling the keep net out of the water was a signal for the carp to come in and feed. You get hammered for 5 hours, the match is finished, there's all that bait lying around that's been thrown everywhere, and they're in.
I've seen that a number of times on lakes that have matches, that the carp come in to feed in the edges straight after a match. I've seen that loads on when I used to fish club lakes a lot back when I was younger. Same on the day ticket lakes, you know, the various where you can't actually fish the night, and every now and again you sneak on or be allowed on or whatever. And you know, literally the second after, you know, the carp's body clock knew when everybody was off and when it was safe to eat, you know, they knew. So without doubt, if everybody on the lake reels in at 10 o'clock in the morning, then the fish are going to know that there's no pressure in there.
Yeah, I do believe even on when you were fishing fen, it was a morning bite time, then there was the late morning, midday bite time, a smaller window, but it was certainly there.
Yeah, and it does change throughout the year. I mean, I'm not sure why. I'm presuming it's something to do with water temperatures. You know, it changes in the summer. As, you know, night times are generally better in the summer because it's cooler and a bit more comfortable for the fish. I'm wondering if, like, I know the autumn period, it does kind of shift to night times as well. I always used to catch like 2 a.m., that kind of time, 2 till 4.
You know what? I'm also thinking oxygen levels in the water have got to help. But I think we need to get someone like Simon Scott on, who is basically half fish, to come on and answer these questions for us.
To answer the question, it's got to be a combination of water temperature, light level, oxygen levels, for sure. It's got to be kind of a mix of those. I'd like to know the exact science. But there's definitely patterns throughout the year. We've got a number of other questions here. We're going to have to save, I think, because each one of these questions could be an hour on its own. You know, this Scott Oakley's wants to know our experience about watercraft, wind temperatures, whatever. Yeah, we could do a whole podcast. Somebody else about approaching a massive body of water. Again, I've got quite a bit of experience of fishing low stock, big lakes. Nothing the size of Lake Bolsena in Italy, which he's asking about, but
I think that's someone we might need to ask a guest, someone like Frank Warwick or Steve Briggs with plenty of experience on these inland seas.
Yeah, but I think for now we've got Crowy waiting in the background, so I think we're going to have to say hello to Mr. Simon Crow.
Welcome to the Carpcast.
Man
of the moment.
Thank you very much.
Man of the moment, I would say. Moment. I mean, you've had an outrageous couple of weeks, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had a few good fish, mate, yeah, but when you work at Carp Talk as long as I have for so many years, you get used to sort of typing up catch reports and seeing people have these little red letter days, and you sit there thinking, well, when's it going to be mine? And, you know, it's nice to know that, you know, I've caught a few decent fish over the last few weeks, and I'm just making the most of it, mate, enjoying it. I'm on a good bait. And that always helps as well, that you're on something good. I mean, you've been carping as long as I have, Jamie. You know, when a good bait comes out, you've got to get on it early. I mean, all baits are eventually pretty much the same, but when something new comes out that you've been tipped off about, it's pretty special. You've got to get on it early. And once you get on it early, you really can have some good catches.
You're talking about the key, of course, for those people that don't know. Yeah. The most controversial bait in recent years, I would say.
Yeah, I listened to you and Alan talking about it last week on the Carpcast, and you know there are people out there that are going to slag it off and slate it, but I think when it comes to spending any amount of money on anything carp, people are always going to criticise it. But you know, it is about quality. It is a quality bait. The ingredients that are in it are not cheap. I spoke to Gary the other week, Gary Bays, who put the bait together, and he was telling me about the stuff that's in it. You can't make it any cheaper, you know. But it is a good bait, and you know, once you know the effectiveness of a good bait on a new water, it is worth paying for it. And you know, at the moment, you know, I've seen some great success to me, because contrary to what a lot of people think about myself, they think I'm out there carping every week, every night, and I'm a full-timer and stuff like that. But I'm not. You know, I don't fish every night. I've got kids, I've got a girlfriend, got a life outside of angling, and you want to make sure that you're on something good, and that's been my choice, mate. I've done really well on it.
I've still not used it, but I think this is why it's caused so much debate, because bait is very personal, isn't it? You get attached to your favourite bait, you get confidence in it, and you know, I've had my favourite baits for a number of years now, you know, based on the S-mix that Gary does, and I'm reluctant to change, and I've got people like you out there saying how good this bait is, and I'm still reluctant, you know, to go for it. But
well, I was like you, mate. But I remember when the S-Mix came out, and I took it to Orchid. Obviously, in the early 1990s, and that really opened my eyes about how good a new bait can be on a pressured water. And that Orchid day ticket water, lots of anglers from all different walks of life. All different baits going in there, and at the time there was, you know, mainline baits that was coming out with the Grange, I think it was back then, that was doing an awful lot of fish in Orchid, and the S-Mix came out, and literally, mate, I put it in the margins and watched these fish feeding on it, and within no time the reeds were bending, the water was all clouded up, and I was like, this is really good, you know, there's something in this that's really stimulating these fish into feeding, regardless of whether they're boarders or not. And since then, I've seen, with Carp Talk especially, so many new baits come out, like Nutribait's Trigger, when that first came out, that was producing so many fish all around the world from places like Cassian, which are anglers from all walks of life. And then you had other baits from the mainline range, like the Shell. You had Solus Club Mix when that came out. So, you know, all of these top companies have a track record of producing really, really good baits. But if you get on them early, instead of sitting there flagging them off and slating them and stuff, you really can have some right results on them, because as we all know, within a couple of 3 years, the bait starts to blow, and then you need something a little bit different.
Yeah, like I say, all the companies have had a flyer at one time in the mainline. It was the Activate for me years ago on the wire.
Yeah.
But I think their sell now is probably got to be one of the best-selling baits of all time, I would say.
Yeah. There's something in these baits, mate, isn't there? And I know it's hard to understand as well for people who don't really know much about bait, but there is definitely something in these baits that does have a trigger towards, you know, bigger fish, older fish, whether it's something to do with the taste factor or what, I don't know. You know, there is no bait out there that will only single out the bigger fish. You'd always get the littler fish as well taking these baits, but older fish, bigger fish, generally they've seen all baits, and they do sort of get stimulated by these new active ingredients or whatever that are in these baits. And as I say, if you get on it early, you can have some right results, and that's what I've done. And I first noticed it with this key, mate, in the winter. And let me just say as well about the key, I don't know about you, mate, I had my first batch about 2 years ago, and I was fishing on Wild View, and I wasn't that keen on it, and it was called Key 6. I think it was a 6 different bait in the development, and it was very soft, it didn't go out really well in a stick, and I caught some tench on it, I caught some small fish, and I didn't really like it. But when Gary came back to me and said, like, this is finished now, I go on it, was when I was fishing at a place last year in France called Echo Pool, and I ended up catching the biggest resident quite quickly, and I was like, maybe there is something in this. And then during the course of the winter, I took it to a water called Emmetland up in the north and east Yorkshire, where I fished quite a lot over the last few years. And let me just say, the lake I was fishing, which is called Pond 3, it's only about 2 or 3 acres in size. I've fished it for 5 or 6 years now in the winter, and I've hardly caught anything, Jamie, on there. You know, I know where the fish live. They're always in the same old spots, you know, either tied to some snags or around the weed beds and that. And all I've been doing over the last few years is fishing the same spots time and time again with same baits and varying different baits, I guess, with varying different baits, I should say. And I've hardly caught anything, maybe two or three fish during the winter months. And then this year, when I went on there with the key, I ended up with over 30 fish in the winter. And during that time, there was only one other fish caught during the winter months, mate. And to me, it was only down to that bait. It wasn't down to what I was doing. There was nothing fancy in my rig. It was the same rig I was using the years before. It was the same spots I was fishing the years before. There was something in that bait that made those fish want it. And obviously, since then, I've gone and you know, I ended up with a 56-12 from Nash's, as well as a fish called Penisdale from there, and then this fish this week from Rainbow. So, you know, to me, it's, you know, there is a bit of element of looking all carp in that we do. There's an element of your experience and what you know about carp fishing, but you also need to combine it with something that's pretty good as well. And, you know, the key is pretty good at the moment.
Yeah, it's, you know, the old adage, a good angler will catch on most baits. You know, an average angler will catch more on a really good bait, but you give a good bait to a good angler and, you know, they're going to crucify places, as you've kind of have been doing since you've had it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like there's loads of lads that I've over the years, mate. You know, I remember when Sticky's Krill came out, that did an awful lot of good fish only a couple of 3 years ago. That was another good bait that did the damage. And at the moment, it's, you know, okay, I work for Nash, I'm going to start plugging Nash. But believe me, if the lads are going to sit there and be all cynical and say, I was only saying that because he works for Nash, this bait's good. It's fantastically good. It's expensive. If you pay the price, then you'll see how good it is. But again, you've got to put it in the right spot. You've got to fish the right areas and, you know, you've got to be on the bank when the fish are having it.
It's very easy to say that just because you're with a company that you know, you're gonna use it, but bait is so important that you're not going to use something that doesn't work. You're a fisherman first and foremost. You know, you're not going to use something that you've got doubts about. I mean, it's quite easy to lose confidence in a bait. I know an example. Roger's been fishing Dinton White Swan, and he loves his bait. I think he's using the DNA stuff recently and absolutely raves about it, hammered everywhere. He had two occasions on Dinton recently on White Swan where people around him were catching, he was on fish, and he didn't catch twice, and straight away lost confidence in the bait on that lake. You know, people were catching on fruity baits, and he was using quite a fishy bait. First thing he did was change the bait, you know, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, he used a fruity bait by the same company, but the fact is, it's you're not going to persevere too long with something that you don't think is that great, because it's, you know, it's kind of the key to it all. The key, ironic.
Yeah, I think the trouble is, as well, nowadays with this social media, like, everybody's got an opinion, and a lot of opinions are based on nonsense. They've been carping a week, they've turned on the telly, bought all the gear. A bit like me with my golf, you know, I think I know how to play golf because I've got the gear, but I've got no idea how to play it. When you start talking to the lads that know how to play it, and, you know, all the lads that start slagging it and knocking it because of the price. You know, there are some really good baits out there. They're really cheap. There's some fantastic baits out there. But, as I say, it goes back to the old word that you said earlier on, mate. It's about experience. And once you've been around carp in a long while, everybody knows that when a good bait comes out, if you get on it early, you can really have some success with it.
I'm glad it's really expensive and loads of people are slacking it, because I'm going to be onto it pretty late, but it means that
I still think you've got a chance, mate. I don't know many people that are still using it. You know, we're getting the odd catch reports on it from Carp Talk. I see the odd catches on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that from the lads out there. I still think people are really reluctant to sort of venture into that £15 a kilo for bait, because they are chucking it into the lake. They can't get it back. It's not like spending £15 on an item of tackle which is there for you for a few weeks or whatever. But, you know, this week, you know, I've gone and put it to the ultimate test on Rainbow, which, if anybody's ever fished Rainbow who's listening to this, they'll know what it's like. It's not the easiest water in the world. You know, it is a water that does get fished 365 days a year by, I don't know how many anglers on there every week, but about 25, 30 anglers. You know, and there's some really, really good anglers from all over the world over there. Alan Dano's there regularly. Arjun from Holland's over there regularly. There's some fantastic English anglers. Alan Taylor. Loads of lads are on that water. The sort of cream of the crop of continental fishing, really. And those lads know what they're doing. And I only go there a couple of times a year. And lo and behold, you know, the second time I've been on the water with the key, I've gone and caught the biggest fish in the lake. Is it coincidence? Possibly. Was I in the right swim? Yes. I'd picked that particular swim when I was given some options. with hopefully the chance of catching him. It's because it's known to frequent an area known as Swim 5. But the key's designed to do that, mate. And Gary Bayes is an expert on bait. He knows a lot more about bait than you and I and everybody else listening. So, you know, is there something in it? Yeah, I think there is. I definitely think there is.
How many times have you been to Rainbow over the years?
I first fished there in 2004. I did a couple of trips there, and at the time I started going through a divorce and stuff, so I never sort of went back till 2011. And since then I've done one or two trips a year. So I think this trip I've just done now was my ninth trip overall. But, you know, of those nine trips now, I've just got the Rainbow bug, mate. If I could fish no other lake other than that one, the rest of my fishing career, I'd be happy, because it just offers so much of a challenge. You know, you get these lads that try and rank fisheries, and they say Euro Aquas, you know, just like a braised nose type fish, or somewhere you can just chuck out and catch fish. Then you've got your commercial lakes, and then your likes of the Rainbow, and then you've got the Orient and the Cashins and stuff above that. But if you fish Cashin and you fish the Orient and fish places like Rainbow, I would rank probably alongside the Cashins and the Orient, because it's a completely different type of fishing. It's so extreme, it's so difficult. You know, it's not difficult to catch the carp out there, but the difficulty is actually fishing it, because of the boats and the obstructions and the nature of the fishing. It's just amazing, mate. It's an eye-opening place. It's a controversial place, because people see the sort of methods that are used on the lake, fishing over small islands and over bars with very, very heavy leaders and strong material and that. But you can't fish it any other way. You really can't. Certainly in some of the swims you can't. You've got to fish it in an extreme style. And it's that nature of the fishing that makes it what it is, because it is, in my mind, one of the ultimate challenges in carp fishing.
Yeah, even though it's well known about, I guess it still kind of feels, you know, that achievement, that hunting side of it, because it is rough and raw. I mean, I've never been. I would love to go. The foreign stuff is obviously something you've been doing for a long time with Husey, and I mean, the World Carp Cup was an early success, wasn't it? Was it 1990-something?
Six, mate, yeah, 1996. Yeah, but I've been going to France since... I think it was 1990 or 1991 when I first started going over to France. I met Rob, obviously, in a tackle shop, which we spoke about on Carpcast number 2, I think it was. I was working in a tackle shop, and this bloke walked in a suit, and I thought, what's he trying to sell us? And turned out he was local, you know, new to the area, and wanted some information on some of the local fishing, and I got him on a small syndicate there, and he'd just been to France for the first or second time, I think, and he said, right, fancy going over to France? And obviously, as a kid, I'd seen the likes of Rod Hutchinson, Kevin Mannix on the front of Angling Times and in the newspapers of the time and in the books of Cut like Carp Fever and that. And I thought, cool, yeah, I'd love to go over to France. And it was a proper adventure back then, because there was always this blanket night fishing ban all over the country. You couldn't fish anywhere legally at night. So it was a little bit of an adventure fishing after hours. And, you know, with the thought that you could get gripped at one time or another by the Garde de Pêche. You know, the two of us did have a few problems with the Garde de Pêche over the years. We've had our rods taken from us, confiscated. We had to pay fines, been in court and stuff like that. It is a petty sort of crime over there, but it's all changed now thanks to the FFPC, I think they call it, the French Federation of Carp Anglers. They changed it all and got the laws all changed and that. So it is a little bit more, it has opened up a lot more to the fishing on the rivers and the canals and the big reservoirs and that. But it's fantastic, mate. I heard you last week talking about, you know, the adventure side of fishing, and I don't get the adventure side of fishing in England. I really don't. It's commercial. It's all busy lakes and secrets and things like that. But the adventure overseas is still available to so many of us. Fantastic place to go fishing, France.
Yeah, I've had my first year ever this year without a syndicate. I've, you know, got a couple of things, like secret-y type things I've been looking at, but I've just found it hard to get motivated without having kind of a goal, you know, like I need the syndicate. And I think
trouble is, you've caught everything, that's the thing. you've caught virtually everything. You're one of the most successful anglers, certainly from the north, mate. You've caught bloody, you know, fish. You live in Blackpool, for Christ's sake. You know, it always makes me laugh when I talk to English carpers and say, oh, he's a legendary carper. He is. Yeah, but the bloke lives in Yateley. He's got all those lakes next to him. You know, during his dinner break, he could pop to the lake and say, you live in Blackpool. Mark Pitchers lives even further north than you. you have to travel sort of 4 or 5 hours till you get to a lake, mate. So to me, there's a little bit of a difference in doing what you've done over the years from Blackpool and travelling down south and fishing on the Yateley compared to the locals that fish that lake, who only have to sort of open the door and walk down the lake and, you know, oh, there's no space today, but I'll come back tomorrow. A little bit different. So I'm not saying that because I live in the north myself. I'm saying that because you live further north than I do, and I don't fish down south. But the stuff that you've achieved, mate, from down south has been mega over the years.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be endorsed by somebody else who's extremely accomplished. But, I mean, it's hard because just that little bit of info, I mean, I might have 3 nights a week somewhere 300 miles from home, and you don't know, you've got no idea what's going on for the 4 days that you're not there. Whereas if you live 5 minutes down the road, you know, you're wandering about there every night, you're walking the dog around the lake, or, you know, you're just totally in tune, you know what's going on. So even if you only get one night's fishing a week, that one night's fishing is probably bang on the money, because you kind of know. And there's, I mean, the nearest lake to me is Wyaside, which is probably 35-40 minutes drive, and again, you know, I caught the fish out of there sort of 15 years ago, so I'm actually going to go next week on one of the day ticket lakes just for the crack, because that's all I'm doing this year. It's been day tickets, and I just I'm in the rat race. It's tough fishing day ticket lakes.
Oh, it's really hard, mate. You know, it's mega hard. I listen to, I see some of these social media posts and you see, and people slating certain angles, which is what carp fishing unfortunately attracts, these people at the green-eyed monsters. And one of my mates, Julian Cundiff, you know, he doesn't sort of target the monster carp, and as a result of that, people turn around and say, "Ah, what have you caught, Julian?" and stuff like that. Well, Julian's caught most of the carp in Yorkshire over the years, where he lives. But Julian, as an angler, you cannot but take your hat off to him. He's got an office job, which is 5 days a week, 9 to 5, and he fishes overnighters in the week. And he's not only, I mean, I fish overnighters, but I walk into Carp Talk wearing my stinky fishing clothes. Julian's got to go home, get showered, put all his aftershave on, do his hair, which will probably take 2 hours. Then he's got to put his suit on and get into the city centre, because he's got a job in the courts. Bloody hell, that takes so much doing, mate, and people don't appreciate it. You know, it's all right sitting on a bank 24/7 smoking dope and catching 40 after 40, but to me, there's a little bit of difference in doing what Julian does compared to what those other guys do. And only today I've been reading an article by Mark Pitchers, and this is for Carp Talk next week, and he's talking about when anglers turn around and say fish off the surface don't count. Well, you know, there's an element of skill in doing that, whereas sitting behind buzzers, sometimes there's not an element of skill. Sitting there and just whacking your rods out and staying there for 2 or 3 weeks, to me, waiting for the carp to turn up, yeah, it's good fun. We all wish we could do it, but it's not as skillful as doing certain other elements of carp fishing, like fishing off the top or doing what Julian does, those overnighters and stuff. It takes a lot out of people.
It's the effort, you know, whichever, like, I've fished a few day ticket places. I still haven't caught a carp this year, and I've been 3 or 4 times. You know, it's been tough. You're fine with other people. You don't necessarily know the background of the lake. I feel lost, you know. I like to work things out. I like to solve the puzzle of a lake, and it's very difficult, you know, when you're just turning up, fitting in between people, you know, people set up around you. It's tough, you know. Respect to anyone that's you know, consistently done well on those sort of lakes for a number of years or more. It's hard. It's really tough. I mean, obviously you work in the industry, you've got opinions, much like myself. You touched on the social media stuff. I mean, it must frustrate you every day, especially in your position in Carp Talk, where you're receiving the phone calls and you're up to date on all the gossip.
Yeah, it does frustrate me. It frustrates me because I mean, I love my job. I love carp fishing. I owe carp fishing more than it owes me. I mean, it's a fantastic industry to work in. And I set out as a young kid to earn a living out of something that I enjoy. And I really, really love carp fishing. And sometimes, I suppose, when I express my opinions, it sounds like I'm knocking it, but I'm not, because it's just the frustrations of sometimes working in it and dealing with people, because there is an element of a core, I should say, within the carping sector and sector community that are that do believe that their catches mean more than everybody else's, and that side of it really winds me up, because when I get a catch report off a young lad who's only 10 years old and he's gone and fished on a local bay ticket water that has recently been stocked with fast growing fish or imported fish or whatever, and he's saying that he absolutely loved catching this fish, it meant so much to him, how can you turn around and say to that lad that it didn't count, or it's a wrong one and stuff like that? It's the wrong way to go with fishing. Fishing is about enjoyment and your own self-enjoyment, and sometimes people believe that carp fishing is only about fishing the raspberries and the wild open waters. Yes, those waters are the venues that have massive credibility, and if you can catch carp from those, you can probably catch carp from anywhere. But not everybody wants to do that, and people have different tastes and enjoyments in the sport, and they should be allowed to go and fish for what they want to fish for and enjoy it just as much as everybody else does.
It's about enjoyment, you know. Who's in, you know, how can you tell anybody else that something they've had a buzz out of, really enjoyed, you know, it might be a personal achievement for them in their personal situation, how can you tell them that that's like not right, you know, you shouldn't have enjoyed that, it's a snide fish, or it's this, or it's, you know,
fish, you can't, mate, you just can't. It's wrong when people are working in the industry earning money off these people and then criticising them, and I think the magazines that promote that kind of behaviour of calling things wrong and suggesting that things are bad, and it's just it's another side of the industry that does frustrate me, because we're all in it together, and there's nothing wrong with putting features in your magazine that are just about the wild and open, really difficult waters of the UK. There's nothing wrong with that and promoting that side of fishing, but there is something wrong in earning money off people that fish these day ticket lakes and these so-called wrong and tight waters, and then criticising them. I don't like that. I call it just hypocrisy to me.
Have you seen it get worse over the years? I mean, you've worked in the media for a long time. Is it getting worse, or is it softening? Are the lines getting more blurred now?
I think it's softening a bit, mate. Now it's definitely softening a bit. It's sort of 10 or 15 years ago, it was, let me just pick out ECHO as an example, English Carp Heritage Organisation. ECHO, when it was originally set up sort of 15 years ago, it set up with the primary intention was to protect English carp stocks. Absolutely. And what Chile did, and Ruth Lockwood with ECHO, was just fantastic, because they got it to a level where they were dealing with people who are working in government and stuff, and their sole intention was to do that. But unfortunately, when you set up something like that, you do get these people who come from a little bit more extreme views and start sort of associating themselves in the wrong way. And I mean, Chile himself has definitely softened over the years. He used to be very, very opinionated with regards to what you could and you can't fish for, but he himself is seeing the light, and now he's doing a fantastic job of what he does. He did a fantastic job with ECHO, as far as I'm concerned. And we're all entitled to change our opinions. And, you know, I've changed my opinions over the years. When I first came to work at Carp Talk, I was a young, naive lad who had similar opinions to what Chile did 15 years ago and what other anglers had 15 years ago. Oh, that's a wrong one, that's a wrong one, that's a right one, that's all these fish count because they've got scales on them and they're dark coloured and things like that. But then my eyes were opened when I started dealing with the likes of Rod Hutchinson and Kevin Clifford, who historically had stocked all sorts of waters over the years. And the one that always makes me laugh was that Ashley Poole, which Jack Hilton used to fish sort of in the 1960s, and those carp to me in the 1980s when I was a young lad were fantastic carp. They've been there for 20 odd years, and they were looked at as being the keep it real type carp. And then you get to Carp Talk and you talk to Kev Clifford, who stocked the lake when those fish went in there. They all went in there at 28, 30 pounds. So, do you know what I mean? There's an element of hypocrisy there. There's photographs of Kev holding these fish, but people ignore that. Oh, the fish that were in Ashley were amazing carp. And you can go down other lakes and do the same sort of comparisons over the years. And it is a very, very grey area. I know where anglers come from when they dislike imported fish. I myself am not a massive fan of huge imported carp. I've got my own opinions on that. My opinions might be slightly different to yours. Yours are different to the other bloke. What is right and wrong is a personal view, and that's where I say we as anglers, as long as we're promoting fishing in the right way, and there aren't lots and lots of deaths coming from imported fish through the spreading of disease, etc., then I don't see what's wrong with anglers fishing for those carp or indeed fisheries that are stocking them, as long as we know what we're fishing for.
I totally agree. I mean, I didn't know about the Ashley Pool. Was that the places with the big cabbages and stuff?
Yeah. See, you've been around carping for ages, mate, and you didn't know about that.
No, I didn't know they were imported, but obviously I do know, you know, like the Collingbrook fish was always the most hypocritical one to me. I mean, that went in like £19 or something, a Kent Riverboard fish was it. But I mean, you know, if the fish in Eric's Willows went in way smaller than that, you know, and
Oh, yeah.
The Collingbrook fish is absolutely as pucker as it gets, and you know, yeah, the big one in Willows isn't. Like, are you having a laugh?
Yeah. It's I think sometimes people do it tongue in cheek, don't they? And then it gets washed off with other people, and you know, carp fishing is about enjoyment, mate, at the end of the day. And the Willows fish, this photograph, Sammy Wayne's Willows, he runs Willows. He sent me photographs when I was fishing on there 5-6 years ago of the fish at tiny weights, and the big one that's in there, 3 scales, he's got photographs of it, 11 pound. You know, he's got photographs of all of them because he himself, Sam, he loves to prove people wrong. And you know, I don't know if you remember about 7-8 years ago when he caught a 35 pounder out of Willows and he sent it into Carp Talk, and he was wearing, and he specifically did this to wind people up, he was wearing a Croatian football team top, and he put it in the mag holding his Croatian top, you know, knowing that his carp had grown from sort of £5 to £35, you know, and they're now 57 pounds, mate. They came from Croatia, we'll tell you they came from Croatia, they came from Umberside Fish Farm. There's some originals in there that were probably flooded in from the river that have been in England all their lives probably, and there's also some fish in there that he stocked in recent years. I don't know whether the Fisher's Pond fish or Simon Scott fish. But a lovely scaly fish that now reaching £30 in weight. But the big ones that are in there, they all came from Humberside fisheries up here, and they've just grown, mate. And they're fantastic fish. And it's a fantastic fishery. And what I can say about that lake, having fished it, is I've fished quite a lot of carp fisheries in my life, mate. The most richest water I've ever fished, I'd say, is the Willows, because I'm one of these anglers when I eat my dinner, I eat one of these pans and stuff, and I always put in the margins. And the next day when I go to get my pan on the Willows, it's just full of snails and larvae and all sorts, mate. It's a mega, mega rich water, it really is. And it's not just a combination of the strain of fish that have gone in there, it's the environment that they've gone into, as well as the bait that's in there now. You know, they're mega, mega fish, mate. And it's a mega fishery what it's created there. And I could have told you when he started it, and he walked, showed me around it, I was listening to what Sam was saying. He said, "Crowe, this is going to be amazing," and he was damn right, mate. And I could have told you when I first walked around that this place is going to be special, and it is.
Yeah, I've only fished it a couple of times, but I'd love to catch that big one. I mean, it's black as the ace of spades, and they're all corkers, yeah. In there. It's got so many decent fish now. It's definitely on my list. One of the few places as a day ticket I could really get into, I think.
Yeah, it's a cracking water, mate.
Yeah, and like you say, I mean, my views on the keep it real kind of stuff has softened over the years as well. You know, I was a donator to Echo when it first started, and you know, I kind of fished for what you would call like the, you know, the true old English ones, but none of them are. You know, most of them came from abroad, and like I mean, the Eric's one is a good example. That big one out there is more quote pucker than the Collingbrook fish, I would say. You know, it has grown probably more of its life in this country, or at least as much, and yet one is absolute, you know, kind of up there with all the keep it real guys, and the other one couldn't be. You know, it's like dirt under the shoe, and it's hypocritical. And like you say, if you knew the facts about half the lakes, you know, there's probably a lot more sort of hypocrisy going on.
Yeah. I mean, the Conningbrook fishes was a mega fish. I don't know where... I've heard all the rumours about it being imported and stuff. I don't know. We had a picture sent into Carp Talk of Trevor Ells, I think it was, and he used to write a feature for our mag, and it was only about £15, and it was definitely two-tone. It was a really, you know, obvious fish. It was that fish. It's grown from £15 or whatever it was. I can't remember. It might have been £18 or something, or 19, like you say, and it grew to 67. Yeah, I mean, it was a mega fish. It was a mega hard fish as well. Anybody who caught that fish, fair dues to them. Mega piece of angling. You can't rank fish, I don't think, that's better than that one or that's better than the other one. It's you could put a recent import into the hardest lake in the world, and it's a completely naive fish, and it becomes completely difficult to catch. You know, so I was at Rainbow last week as an example, and when I was at Rainbow, I saw some fish in a margin where the fish had never probably been caught before. It was at the back of one of the snags, but it was an area I looked at and I thought, God, I can get a fish out there, no problem whatsoever. I was walking round and I took some bread in, and this fish just came up off the surface, mate. Started munching like you wouldn't believe off the surface. Put in a rod with 55-pound line on, mate. I had a 55-pound mono on that was all twisted, and it was the most crudest looking rig you could possibly think of, and just lugged it out, just took it straight away and caught one off the top. Now, those are pressured fish in an area where they've probably never been caught before, and they've certainly never been caught off the surface. So, you know, carp, we learn as anglers what they're like, and I do think that sometimes when people start referencing wrong-uns and right-uns, it can be termed in the wrong way. As I understand it, Ringstead, now that's a lake that gets termed a lot wrong, that they're wrong-uns in there and stuff like that, but it's a rock-hard lake. The lads that fish there, even after 2 or 3 years of those fish going in there, it was difficult. There were some really, really good anglers on there, and Alan Taylor and people like that, they'll tell you, it's not an easy water. So sometimes when anglers refer to these fish as being easy fish, or trying to degrade them in some ways, you know, you can't degrade the angling skills sometimes, because there's some top anglers fishing for these carp.
Yeah, it's the merit of capture. I mean, some people just want to catch fish, they enjoy catching fish, and fair enough. I think if you're kind of, you know, you're hunting out fish and you're kind of, you know, pitting your wits against them, it's all about the merit. If somebody goes and drops, you know, 10, 40 pounders in, they might purchase legally from abroad, drop them in a lake, and they get caught 6 times a year for the next 2 years. That isn't the same as going and, you know, spending 3 years chasing the Conningbrook fish or one, you know. Yeah. It's
a massive difference, mate. Yeah.
That's where my personal views are. You know, they've all come from wherever. I just don't like the large stock, you know, kind of the instant carp ponds. That's the only thing I have.
I know what you mean, mate, but they represent an element of the market, and people pay the money to go and fish them, so let them do it, as far as I'm concerned. You know, let them do it, because it all contributes to the carp fishing pot in one way or another, and anybody who's working in the industry will in some one way or another be earning off those type of venues. They'll go and buy some bait, and they'll fish those lakes with that bait, and then that bait's open to pay anglers wages or whatever, and if they don't like it as much as they say they don't like it, then stop working in the industry. You know, you can't turn around and say, we're only selling bait to anglers that fish at Raysbury and Conningbrook and stuff like that. You just can't do it. You know, as much as you want to, but if you're really, really against it that much, which some of these anglers like to say that they are, then bugger off. Just get out of the industry, stay out of the industry, stop being commercial. You know, that's another one that I have a massive gripe with. These people that try and think that they're cool by, oh, I'm not commercial, I'm anti-commercial, I'm proper sort of hardcore underground angler. If you're a hardcore underground angler and you don't like publicity, then get out of magazines, get out of the industry, and stay out of it, and stop telling everybody that you're something that you're not, because you know one name in the industry I'm going to name, which is Johnny Holt. Johnny Holt, Secret John, as he goes by the name, he's going to hate me mentioning his name. Johnny Holt is a proper hardcore underground angler. You will not see any pictures of him in print. He's caught most of the carp in England. He's an amazing angler. People like Steve Alcott and all, he's no longer in print and stuff. They've caught some. These are guys that are proper anti-commercial. You know, they used, maybe they were one day, but they've changed their mind and they've changed their views for one reason or another. But people who are in the trade, who are happy to put pictures on Facebook and show people that they're what they're catching and stuff like that. These are guys, you can't class these as hardcore underground. It's just hypocritical to me.
Yeah, the lines are blurred when, you know, fishing's a very passionate hobby for some people, a way of life almost, but it's also a business for others. You know, going back to the fit, I'm a businessman, I've run a number of businesses over the years. If I had the perfect lake that I could purchase tomorrow and I had 40 grand to stock it and it was simply a money making exercise, you know, there'd be wrong uns going in it and I'd be taking 100k a year and 30 quid a day tickets. You know, that's a business. And you'd be daft if you didn't go down that route if you were just, you know, if it was your job, if that's how you make your living. You can still go fish, you know, the hardcore lakes for your personal fishing, but, you know, people get upset when other people make money out of fishing. Goes back to the key bait controversy as well, I think, you know, because something's a bit dearer than everything else. Everyone's got an opinion on it, and, you know, we live in the real world, you know, people have to make money to sustain things. As we said about the carp cast, you know, this can't go on forever if we don't find a way of recouping the money as passionately as I wanted to do it. You know, it costs money to do it, so we love it, but, you know, business is business.
You know, it is unfair sometimes what carp fishing gets on social media and on the banks. You know, people start knocking, it's all about the money, it's all about this, it's all about that, I'm not paying this amount of money, but they'll then go and pay that amount of money in another industry, which is just the same. All industries are the same. They all exist to make money and keep people in jobs and for people to exist. And carp fishing does get a lot of criticism from people. You know, that's commercial, that's this, that, the other. But, you know, they're happy to go and be commercial in something else. And carp fishing doesn't deserve it because it is, as you know, mate, you've been in the trade. There's some really, really lovely people in carp fishing. There really are. You know, I've made some lifelong friends, not just in the industry, but on the banks. Fishing is an amazing sport, and it brings communities together. It bonds people's lives together. And sometimes when you see stuff on social media and the green-eyed monsters come out, you think, oh, God, you know, that isn't carp fishing. It's a lot better than sometimes it's portrayed in social media, etc.
I think all industries probably have it. I made a similar analogy when people were complaining about the price of the key, you know, and, you know, actively trolling Nashi on his Facebook and stuff. And I'm like, you know, do you troll Gillette on the price of their razor blades, or do you troll Rolls Royce because they make a car that's 200 and something thousand pound? No, because you're not a petrol head into cars, so you don't really care about that. You are an angler, so you're whinging on Nash's page about the price of a bait. So it's, you know, I'm sure that the petrol heads, a guy that buy the car magazines and go to all the rallies and stuff, I'm sure they're got opinions on Porsche's latest offering or whatever it's. So maybe it does equate, but you know, there's a lot. If you don't complain about one thing and you do complain about others, again, you're a hypocrite. You know, at the end of the day, I think the other thing is people that haven't run their own business are very naive as well to the way things work. They just see something cost X amount and they think, oh, you're making loads of money. It probably costs 2 quid a kilo to make and you're selling it for 15. They don't understand, you know, staffing, taxes, transport costs, markup from shops, reps, commission. You know, that some people are just naive to it all and just think, you know, you're having it off. We run the fishing show, as you know. It costs over 100k to put that show on, about £110,000 each year it's cost. We're yet to make a penny out of it 3 years down the line. We've had our houses on the line and all sorts.
You should have done this year, mate. That was a great show this year. It was absolutely rammed this year. You deserve to. You deserve to make something out of it.
But we've had to put our balls on the line to do it. And there's people on Facebook saying it should be free, these companies are making enough money anyway, it should be free entry. I'm just like, I've got the faintest idea.
you can't have everything free in fishing. It's just, people have got to make a living somewhere down the line. But it does. Going back to that key thing, no matter when I put a fish on Facebook or Twitter, if I put something up and say caught on the key, you'll always get two or three people turn around and say, "Oh, well, I wouldn't buy it." Well, so what if you wouldn't buy it, mate? You know, it always amazes me how it tracks that sort of stuff, fishing, because you go on there recently and you've seen that the Euro Aqua's just done that world record this week, £105. Underneath it, I'd never fish there. So what? You know, do we post on pictures? When you put, "Here's me with my wife. Here's me with my beautiful wife." Well, I wouldn't do her. You know, you don't put those things on it, do you? You know, I wouldn't go out with her. I wouldn't marry her. So why do we feel the need? Not, I say we. Why do anglers feel the need to criticise what somebody else is doing? It's crazy. It's crazy.
Some people have miserable lives. They hate the job.
Yeah.
They wish they had more time fishing. They wish they had free bait. They wish they had this. They wish they had that. And the way they make themselves feel better is putting other people down. And that's human nature. You know, I don't agree with it, but I'm a positive person. You know, I look for the plus sides of everything. We all have shit going on in our lives. We all have tough times.
Yeah.
You know, but what separates us is how you deal with it. You know, you can back down and be a victim, or you can, try and make yourself happy. And not everybody has a job in an industry that they enjoy. And so I do kind of sympathise, but it's also, you know, everybody makes choices. The people that are on the bank 5 days a week have made choices to do that. You know, most of them haven't been left 500k as an inheritance and don't have to work. Most of them suffer by choosing the life they do, and who am I to put them down because they catch more 40s and 50s than me.
I know. You hear people saying it about Terry, don't you? You know, Terry Hearn, mate, he's an amazing angler. He's an amazing bloke. And to me, you know, there's laying at the top of the echelons in the UK carping. But Terry, what a role model, a great guy, lovely personality, lovely person. It's like anything. Terry, you're not born heavyweight champion of the world. You're not born Usain Bolt. You put the effort in. He put the training in. Terry puts the training in, puts the effort in. He goes fishing. Fishes more than most people, probably. I don't know what I've done about these days. I don't know what he's doing these days. He keeps himself very quiet. But certainly in the olden days, if you read his books, you'll see the effort that he put into his fishing. Does he deserve the results? Bloody well does, mate, as far as I'm concerned. He's put the effort in, and fair play to him.
Of course he does. I mean, you can see the struggles in his first book. You know, he was taking handouts of food off other people leaving the complex. And, you know, it's tough, and you make your sacrifices for something you want to do. And as long as it's your choice, you know, like I say, some people are negative, and some people, they get their energy from putting other people down because it makes them feel better. Yeah. And they're always going to be there. You know, I've had my share of grief over the years on forums and stuff, and I don't even read stuff anymore. And I used to want to argue with everybody and put them straight, and it's...
You're getting old, mate. That's like me. You know what I'm like? I'm massively opinionated. I always give my opinion to anything. I've never backed down on much at all, but as I've got older, I just can't be arsed with it now. Just chill.
As I understand people more, it just doesn't even register with me anymore. It's, you know, water off a duck's back, to name a cliche, but... You know, it's pretty. Yeah. It doesn't affect me. Somebody goes, "Oh, have you seen that on that forum? Someone saying you did this." I'm like, so, you know, it won't even intrigue me enough to read it. You know, because I know the truth about everything, as do people around me, and nothing else really matters. You know, people are people. They're gonna whinge about stuff for their own reasons. But
You chill out as you get older, mate. Don't you as well? You just can't be bothered with it. I mean, there's things that wind me up. There's things that get me back up from time to time. But do I bother commenting on everybody who gives a negative opinion? No, I don't, because life's too short, as you say. You've got to be positive about everything. And carp fishing as an industry is so positive. There's so many good people in the sport. It's and long may that continue, as far as I'm concerned.
Definitely. I think the main change is the fact that people have a voice now with the social media. I mean, you know, 12 years ago, there was the odd forums, but that was it, you know, and they were notoriously negative. But now with Facebook, like, you know, most people, including me, you know, spend Lord knows how many hours a day, you know, on it. It's full of gossip and interesting stuff, but it's just giving people a voice, I think, that wouldn't normally have had an opinion and probably wouldn't dare say anything to your face, you know.
But the one that in recent times, right, sorry to put in there, Jay, I've just got to say this as well, because last week I was fishing at Rainbow and I caught that bigger than that, and I had a few people comment on my page saying, how do me and mortals fish at Rainbow? It's all right for you lot, the chosen few. I ain't a chosen few. You know, the people that I know that fish there are not chosen few. They're just anglers that have gone to the lake or know someone and made inquiries to fish there. There is nobody that's a chosen few to fish at Rainbow Lake. It's like anywhere. Get on a syndicate, no one knocks on your door and says, hi, do you want to go on the top syndicate in the UK? Oh, yes, please. I'd love to be, you know, selected. Hi, do you want to go and fish at Rainbow Lake? It don't happen like that. You've got to put yourself out. You know, when I first got to fish Lake Reduta, as an example, back in the mid-1990s, the amount of phone calls I made to try and network and try and uncover how can you get to fish on these waters. And I think some people in today's day and age want things at the click of the button. You know, and they think that if you fish at Rainbow, you're something special, you're something different. You're not. It's just anglers. It's just people. And doors open for you if you're willing to get off your arse and try and open those doors. And it's the same in all walks of life. If you're expecting people to knock on your door and say, hi, you've just been chosen to be the next lottery winner, it don't happen like that. You've got to buy a lottery ticket.
No, doors don't open when you sit there whinging about things on Facebook. You know, networking's an important skill in life in any industry. And then, you know, sitting there thinking, it'll never happen to me, or I can't do this, or, you know, it's a negative outset from the off, and you know it's very difficult to achieve anything if you've got that kind of mindset. And the net result of that is you put other people down for them putting themselves in that position. But I mean, are there any, talking about the big kind of foreign lakes, the Rainbows? I know I read your blog, and it was saying about the Orient is somewhere that like kind of holds a special place. Have you actually fished it, or is it somewhere you really want to?
I fished it a couple of times, mate, but not properly. I fished it when it was before it was a sort of a main lake in the early 1990s. Off Oran Shanti with Robbie in probably 91, something like that. Was one of the first places we went to, and obviously Shanti's not far from the Orient. But at the time, there was not much known about it, and it was known for being rock hard. You know, you've got 6,000-7,000 acres of water at the time, there's hardly any carp in it. That's got a few more carp in it nowadays, but it's definitely somewhere I'm hoping to go to. And this year, I've managed to sort myself a trip for the back end of autumn. I'm going to go and have either a week or 2 weeks over there with Jim Lightfoot, who's been on there quite a few times. He's from your neck of the woods, northwest area. And it's a water that, it still, to me, represents one of the ultimate challenges in carp fishing. If you can catch a 60 or a 70 or even a 50 out of the Orient, then, you know, that's a proper carp. It really is. You know, it's where you know you've got...
Does anybody actually know what's in there? Is it still a bit pioneering-y?
I think Andy Chambers and the like, the lads that have fished it regularly over the years, will have a nice photo album of fish that are in there. They're going to know what the stock is nowadays. And certainly, when I last spoke to Andy, I think it was about four or five different 70s in their pod, probably a few more. A 70 from the Orient, a 70 from a commercial lake, you know, you rank them differently. But to me, the Orient's just that little bit special. It's just represents something a little bit next level up, if you know what I mean, a Raisby or a Collingbrook, somewhere like that, because at the right time of the year, in the autumn time especially, the water levels go down because it's a supply reservoir, so you've got the mud to contend with. So much mud, it gets all over your hands, your gear, everything. And if you've been on there for a week, it really sort of eats away at your mind, and you know, makes it uncomfortable. And you've got to endure the rain, the winds, the conditions that are on there, the low stock, and also the limited areas that you can fish. So it's a massive challenge, mate, to get anything out of there. So if I go over there this year in the autumn, like I'm planning to, the aim is to just catch a carp out of there. Doesn't matter whether it's a 20 or a 30. That's my aim. If it's bigger, then obviously I ain't going to turn it down, because it's a mega place to have on your CV.
Where else would you say abroad is kind of the equivalent of what, you know, the Orient is in France?
Yeah, there's lots of different places, mate. I think the one thing that carp anglers do more than anything is that we're all, me included in this, we're all sheep. We tend to follow the crowd. And if you're a pioneer and you've got the balls to go and pioneer some of these waters out in the Gulf area, you've got to be a brave man to go and fish out there. But to give you an example, probably about 10, 15 years ago, I had a lad who was married to a Syrian lass send me some photographs of some carp that was caught from a massive supply reservoir out there. And these fish were like 13, 40 pounds, and they were beautiful mirrors. And he didn't want them going into print because he didn't want people going there, over there on the back of what he was saying. And it was a dangerous area then. So what it's like now is, you know, ridiculously dangerous. But there's unknown quantity of carp all around the world in various different countries. I've got a mate who lives in Brazil who's been catching carp for 40 pounds down there. I had a mate last month or the month before, he went over to Cuba and he only caught fish of 7-8 pound carp. But from the stories and the photographs that he was hearing from the locals, there was certainly some bigger fish out there. It's an unknown quantity, mate. Are there other Orients out there? If I had to put a guess on it, I'd say yes. You know, there absolutely definitely are. There's some unknown carp, some unknown monster fish out there to be found. I mean, let's go back to 1997, 1998 when Meduta was discovered, Lake Saraleste in Romania. At the time, everyone was talking about world records and stuff. There's never going to be anywhere like Cassian. There's never going to be anywhere like the River Seine. Lo and behold, up turned Lake Meduta and some carp to over 80 pounds, which nobody knew about. You know, it was purely by chance that that place was discovered. There's going to be other areas of the world where there's going to be carp that are just growing now in natural life and they're probably going to weigh 70 and 80 pounds and never been caught because they have been introduced into hundreds of different countries around the world. So how many of those places have carp anglers discovered? Probably a small fraction of them.
Yeah, that's a bit of me now, I think. I think that's possibly my future, is those sort of places, the big new ones. I'm like you, I don't fancy Euro-Acre, even though, you know, I wouldn't say no to 100.
I've been to Euro-Acre. I've never fished Euro-Acre. I've been there twice, and it is what it is. You know, I enjoyed it. I went over there to catch a 70 and I caught one. I enjoyed it, but it is very, 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 it's a very commercial water. And if you're willing to go there and spend the money to go there, you can have a great trip. Because it's a lovely place to go with a few mates you're up with. If you hire the lake out exclusively, you can have some enjoyable fishing there. You know, but the carp aren't the same as the ones from Cassian or even Rainbow or places like that. They're completely different.
Have the fish come from Balaton?
According to the owner, when I interviewed him, which was last year, there's various fish farms around the Balaton area, Balaton Derricks area, where it's located. There's fish farmers that have got nets in areas of Balaton itself where they commercially net it and they sell fish to him. Has the all the big fish that are in Euro-Acre, are they stocked from Balaton as stolen fish of 30 kilos, which is what I'm hearing from various different sources all over the world? Are they? The owner says not. I've seen photographs of some of those fish weighing 13, 40 pounds, and I've also seen them at 70, 80 pounds. So he does certainly buy them at small from that area and move them over. He's only just recently put in quite a few sort of 20s and 30s, which came from a fish farmer in that area. I don't know whether he's put any biggins in, mate. Alex is a massive character. He's a really nice guy who owns Euro-Acre, and he said to me that he'd never moved any of the big fish out of the lake, out of Lake Balaton. I mean, bloody hell, the quarter lads have been over there recently and had a massive haul of fish, but the biggest they caught was 40 pounds. It's not easy. It's not somewhere you can go to, Balaton, and just get a 30-kilo fish from. The fish that are in there, there's loads of little ones, and certainly some of them have been netted out and by the fish farmers and sold to Alex and moved into his lake, but they've grown to the sizes that they are in Euro-Acre.
Would you reckon there are kind of 35-kilo fish in Balaton, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course there are, yeah. It's massive, mate. It's a huge place. You know, there's carp fishing in Hungary is like carp fishing in England now. It's a massive, massive industry. There's a magazine over there that has a good circulation. There's carp shows that are over there. There's carp anglers in Hungary that are as dedicated as there are in England. And these guys are fishing places like Balaton. They're fishing places with unknown potential in those countries. And these guys will tell you, these waters have got these fishing. And there's going to be fishing in Balaton that are well known, that are like the same carp in England that are well known. Like, we've got the parrot down at the Wasing Estate, etc. You know, we know the fish, we can identify them. There's fish in Balaton that are known fish, mate. Have any of those been nicked and put into Uruacqua? Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I was more asking, not because of any interest in Uruacqua, it's more that, you know, could there be a 90-pounder swimming about in Balaton? Because I can see myself going there, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think when you look at a carp, and a natural carp in its natural environment without bait, this is something that Rod always said to me, they'll only grow to certain sizes. And historically, you've got to look at when caching was discovered. The biggest fish that was in there was 77, 78 pounds. Biggest fish that was in Reduta prior to anglers getting on there was 82, 81 pounds. Same as the Orient, you know, mid-70s. These are fish that are living natural lives without angler's bait. And I think there has to be a line that you sort of can guesstimate. They'll not grow beyond on natural food. And that's around about the sort of mid-80s size. So is there going to be a 90-pounder, a 100-pounder in Balaton? No, I don't think there is, mate. You know, Uruacqua's got fish 205 pounds, and the reason they're that big is purely through the amount of bait that goes in there. And I mean, the amount of bait that goes in Uruacqua is ridiculous. I went there in November a few years ago, mate, and during the course of the week that we were there, in November, freezing cold weather, there was probably 500 kilos of bait that went into the lake. So, you know, and they were feeding on it as well, mate. They, everything was gone. You could cast out a single grain of corn the next day, and you could probably catch a fish on it.
Yeah, it's. I agree that probably that 80-pound is like a bit of a ceiling, and you know, you're gonna have to feed them to get them bigger. I mean, I think the kind of UK ceiling is maybe not much bigger than 40. I don't think that fish can kind of grow to naturally without bait. Maybe mid 40s.
Yeah. Well, redmere fish was 51, mate, wasn't it?
Yeah, heavily spawn bound though.
Fish, really. Yeah. There could be a spawning one out there, I suppose. It's in one of these big lakes that might make 90. You know, but you're right, mate. There is a 45, something like that in England. It's probably about right.
You had the red mire to yourself, did you? Did you not book the lake for yourself one opening day or something?
Yeah, I did, mate. Yeah, back in 2004 or 2005, I can't remember when it was. It was something I always wanted to do, for the opening week of Redmere. You know, it's the Wembley of carp fishing, and I'm one of these guys. All right, I've caught an 86-pounder this week, but tonight I'm going fishing on a lake that's got carp no bigger than 30 pounds in it. It doesn't matter. I'm not just driven by size, I'm driven by enjoyment as well, and Redmere was somewhere that I always wanted to fish. And I had the opening week on there. Just got divorced. Ed was all over the place. Wife was in the house with a boyfriend and things, you know, and the head was just shot to pieces. I thought, bang, there you go, £1,500, book the lake for myself, and biggest to call was 24-12, but what a week. Loved it, mate, fantastic.
Is it beautiful? Is it a stunning place?
Oh, man, it's the Wembley Cup, isn't it? It's where it started, mate, you know. Although I accept carp fishing for what it is today, with as we've gone on about the imports and the commerciality of it, you have to respect the history of the sport. You have to respect the anglers that have created the history. And that's why I've got a lot of time for the likes of Rod Hutchinson, Chris Yates, Chris Ball, Kevin Clifford, Tim Paisley, all these guys, Kevin Nash. They've created what we've got. And there's also the fisheries that have created what we've got. And Redmere, in my mind, you can't call yourself a carp angler unless you've been to Redmere, because that's where it started. And you can go back and just see what it was once and still experience it, what it is today. And there's still some lovely, lovely fish in there, mate. It doesn't matter how big they are. I booked the lake for a week. To give you an example, my mate Rob Hughes came down on for one night at the week. I offered him a few more nights, but he was so busy, Rob, he could only get down there for a night. He only caught one carp. It was about 7 pounds. But Rob was like a kid at Christmas. Oh, I've got a redmere carp. That's what it was like, mate. I was like that before I caught my first redmere fish. Just wanted to catch one. Just wanted to touch one. It's Redmere. Redmere, I know. It's the best place. It's what created it, isn't it?
Yeah, but when I was a kid, I had those same sort of feelings. It was the Mecca, you know. It was, you know, the two British records came from there, you know, the Dick Walker one as well as the Chris Yates, you know, there was nowhere else. It was there, you know.
There's
there
three British records from there, mate. There's Bob Richards as well. Bob Richards had his 30-pounder. He was the first one with the British record, and then there was Dick Walker's, then there was Chris Yates's.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think that's a nice note to end on, really, going back to the kind of why we do it, you know. It's that I don't know, it's the mystical environment that they're, you know, like Chris Yates's passion for angling, it was that's that idealistic sort of beautiful out there pitting your wits against the carp. I think that's why we kind of do it, and we forget that sometimes with the overstocks and the commercials. And
these venues are still there though, mate. This is the one thing I'll say to people that say carp fishing's not what it was and it's been ruined. No, carp fishing can still be what it was, and it still is what it was, because there are people now fishing these big Cambridgeshire lakes, these big waters, in this, even in Yorkshire where I live, there's some big lakes that's got, you know, haunted memories. Although there's, I know lads that are fishing on it as an example, you know, there's the unknown element there to the majority of people. And if you want to go back in time and experience the unknown, it's still there. Even in England, you can go and fish lots of different farm ponds and not really know what's in them, the rivers, the canals. There's untapped carp there to be had. So it isn't just commercial carp fishing. It's still there for everybody. It's just not quite like what it used to be, as in there are commercial waters that are out there. But if you don't like them, stay away from them and just enjoy what you want out of your carp fishing, because it's there for everybody.
Definitely. Well, we're over an hour, so thank you very much for your time. And not got
thank you.
Half.
Thanks for asking us, mate. I think it's a great programme, this. I've listened to every show, so... I'm sure it's got a wicked future, because it is certainly something that a lot of people are talking about, and I wish you and Mark the best of luck with it, because it's fantastic, mate.
Thanks very much for your time, Simon. Speak soon, pal.
Big thank you to Simon. It's great to have Crowe on, especially as he's been in the news tons recently. And it's been a pretty long podcast, this one, so I think we're going to wrap it up fairly shortly. But is there anything that's caught your eye that's worth a look?
Worth a look.
Nothing worth a look. Carp Team England Facebook page. Give it a look and give it a like. Show Rob Ewells your support, because we all want England to get back on the top of the world of carp fishing.
Yeah, we spoke about... you know, Rob's plans already. I think he's thinking about it extremely well, as a manager should. You know, he's trying to cover all the angles with the casting and stuff. And yeah, I noticed loads of pictures have been going up on the Carp Team England page. Basically, companies offering support. I think Fox went up there today. His pictures of him with Fox.
Worth a look.
Also worth a look. I know we mentioned it before, but the Fox DVD. While we're talking about Fox, they've launched a competition this week. I forget what the actual prize is now, but it was quite decent. It's basically, you've got to take a selfie of yourself and the new Fox free DVD that they're giving away. And there's been some quite funny pictures sent in already. The latest one I've seen was Bev Clifford of Carp Talk and Fishing Fame with a cheeky picture with her with it in her mouth, in her teeth. You've basically got to take a selfie with the new Fox Edges DVD. And what can you win? You can win £100 worth of Edge products, I think, at the end of this bank holiday weekend. So this Carpcast is out on the Friday. You've still got a chance to get in. So if you haven't seen the DVD, check it out. It's worth a look. But definitely get your selfie taken.
Yeah. Have you seen it yet?
I've not watched it, no. And I would take a selfie myself if I had one. I might need to the tackle shop shortly, actually, because I will be fishing Cromwell this week, so I need to get in and get a few bits. I'm going to pick one up.
Yeah, I think I'll do the same. Got to be in it to win it.
Cool. And we've not had a carp paint sheep for a few weeks. I know there's a couple of things that have been bothering you.
Carp are not sheep.
But carp anglers are.
They certainly are.
GoPros and YouTube blogs.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what you say about this, as I've just bought a GoPro and was going to document a few little bits.
It's okay. I got one for Christmas from my good wife. Yeah. And I actually took it with me this week, fishing. I stuck it to the car window, talked a bit of crap as I was driving down there, but then caught nothing to back it up, so I've deleted everything.
I've started making a number of videos and stopped. I've started making a few because I haven't had the fish to finish it off, so yeah.
Yeah. Now, I have got a few that I have done that are already on YouTube. Don't go and watch them because they're crap. But in all seriousness, there are a few little points here if you're going to do anything that you can make. Firstly, just try and make them interesting on a variety of levels. Try not to repeat yourself. If you do want to add any product plugs in there, just one for each product and spread them out. Don't go on and on and about the same thing because people will just turn off. And people want to see fish. They want to see action. They don't want to see you sat there having your third coffee of the morning talking rubbish about what birds diving on your baits.
Are you talking about one particular Cambridge blogger in particular?
I wasn't actually, but no.
You've just summed him up in a couple of sentences. Yeah, these. I quite liked watching. What was he called? Carp Catcher or something?
Yeah.
I forget what he's called now. He made a load of blogs, and there were lots of making brews. Some interesting ones. I did watch quite a few. I know Shelley had a few public run-ins with him, didn't he? There were. Yeah. See, Shelley's blogs. Some of them are interesting, some of them are downright annoying, but he was kind of the first person to do it properly. But I mean, people want to watch a well-known angler way more than they want to watch Joe Bloggs making his brews and rolling his latest joint, you know. It's I feel a little bit, I think it's a little bit narcissistic, the whole videoing yourself, the whole selfie thing. It makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. I don't do it, and I have tried making videos in the past, and I don't know, something doesn't make me feel that comfortable about it. That one of the lakes that I've been fishing on, the sneaky sort of places, I've wanted to document, because if there's anything special in there, if I catch something really nice, it will make a really good story. And I wish I'd video stuff of you know, some of the fish that I've caught in the past and some of the experiences. I really wish I had had it documented. So, but if you're kind of just a nobody, unless you need a story, you need a point to it, as opposed to just, you know, here's a picture of me rods, here's me making a brew, this is my session, I'm sat on this lake, you know, then there needs to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think that's kind of the point of it. At least in Shelley's blogs, there's millions of them, but you know he's going to catch stuff. You know there's going to be a fair few fish in it. And some people have done it brilliantly. Laney, you know, all his Burfield stuff. He's got the Burfield fish on there. That's what people want to see. Go and catch a fish like that, people want to see it. So, but yes, everyone and his uncle's doing it. So,
yeah, I'm particularly enjoying Dave Lane's at the minute because he's on Shallow Lagoon at St Ives. And obviously knowing the lake and knowing a lot of the fish, I'm enjoying them. He's also catching them a lot better than what I did, to be honest.
Yeah, so more Laney stuff and less nobody's, please. Carp are not cheap.
Yeah. Right, before we finish, I'm just looking through the YouTube subscriptions I've got. So if anybody wants to look at a few, apart from all the companies I've got on there, Steve Briggs, Ian McMillan, Ting Tong's even got his own YouTube channel. Simon Crow's on there as well. Who else have we got? There's Joe Rogan. That's worth a look if anybody likes some randomness.
Yeah, if you like spoken word podcasts, if you're enjoying the Carpcast, and maybe this is your first kind of podcast you've really listened to, what gave us the idea for doing this was the Joe Rogan Experience. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds to listen to, and it's not about fishing. There's some MMA stuff on there. He's a stand-up comedian, so there's quite a few comics on there. But basically, it interests guys struggling through life. You know, it's kind of a philosophy, an entertaining, funny, Mickey taking philosophy podcast. It's hard to describe. It's hard to put it into words. But the Joe Rogan Experience, trust us, listen to a few of them, and I think I think you will enjoy it.
Doesn't matter if you don't know who his special guest is, just give them all a listen.
They're all worth listening to.
Yeah.
I found a summary actually on the net. I'm going to get it up now quickly that really summed up the podcast way better than I've just attempted to. I've just found it now. It's on Coconut Daily. In fact, the fact that if you've never listened to the Joe Rogan Experience, if you Google 10 best Joe Rogan podcasts, you'll find a list of 10. There's quite a few people that have done a top 10. Should be in the Worth a Look section, this, really.
Worth a look.
But the one I always go to is Coconut Daily. It kind of links his first best one, his best 10. If I can just read. The Joe Rogan Experience is one of the most fascinating and enlightening podcasts on the internet. Joe forays into the paranormal, otherworldly and metaphysical, or sometimes genuinely thought-provoking. His new guests range from famous comedians, disheveled journalists to renowned scientists. And if you're sceptical of him, mind expanding. It's surreal. They talk about aliens, you know, other potential worlds, multiverses. He's had, you know, people like Neil deGrasse Tyson on, you know, like super scientists. He has some really interesting guests. Lots of authors write books on ancient underwater lands, and you name it. There's a bit of everything on there, from downright piss taking, you know, the stories. He has Joey Coco Diaz on. Anyone with him, he used to be a cocaine dealer selling Whitney Houston, Charlie, back in the day, along with many other people. Some of his stories are outrageous. He's the real deal. Shane Smith, Smith
from Vice,
yeah, who owns Vice magazine. They're worth listening to. But yeah, some of the top MMA fighters on there. Even Dana White, who owns the UFC, he's had him on there. There's too many to mention. I suggest if you're going to get into Joe Rogan, Google top 10 Joe Rogan podcasts. Because I know people say about our podcast, the best thing I listen to spoken word podcasts for is traveling and driving, because it really kills time. The Joe Rogan podcasts are 3 hours each, and there's hundreds of them, if not 1,000 now. There's a lot. He's definitely up to 400 plus, I would say.
Oh, 650.
Wow, 653-hour
podcast.
We've got
some catching up to do.
Yeah, I've listened to every single one of them. I got onto them and I went back through all the old ones. And a lot of people say to us, you know, once every 2 weeks is not enough for these podcasts, because people, you know, Nathan at Cromwell, he's like, when I'm on the tractor mowing the grass, you know, I've got it on my headphones. Other people, you know, Hughesy spoke to him the other day, he's like, when I'm driving, it just totally kills the time. So if you can't get enough Carpcast and you want another spoken word podcast to listen to, Joe Rogan is the one.
Yep, and we've got to be running out of time about now.
Oh yeah, we've done loads. So,
about half an hour ago.
Yep, so we're going to knock it on the head for this week. But hope you've enjoyed the show, and we'll see you for Carpcast 8.
Yep, see you next time.